Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Davis Malm. Their tax lawyers are committed to your most taxing matters. Learn more at davismalm.com. That's DAVISMALM.com. Davis Malm. Lean. Agile. Strategic.
I'm Jim Browdy, ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. We'll open the lines on the second anniversary of January 6th. As 20 House Republicans continue a different sort of insurrection 2 years later. Then President Biden recently released a sweeping federal plan to end homelessness in America in the next 3 years with a focus on supportive housing. Lyndia Downey, executive director of the Pine Street Inn, one of the largest groups supporting people experiencing homelessness in the region and building supportive housing, she joins us at the BPL.
I'm Marjorie Egan. South Carolina Supreme Court has just struck down a six-week abortion ban, reaffirming the right to abortion in the state. GBH's Callie Cross will be joining us on that and more. Then former Public Safety Secretary Andrew Cabral discusses the 15 police officers in Massachusetts suspended through the Police Officer Standards and Training Commission, many facing serious criminal charges. All that to come on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library, as we do every Tuesday and every Friday. And we are streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. Yep. Oh, we have a special broadcast next Friday,
too. We do.
Yes, at the Embrace Unveiling down on the Boston Common. Mm-hmm. Very exciting. Going to be there all afternoon.
Well, we're going to be there more than all afternoon. We're starting at 11 o'clock, 11 to 1. We're going to interview and talk to a lot of the people involved in making this happen, including some pretty prominent souls. 1 o'clock on, we will cover the ceremony live to its conclusion. And when the ceremony's over, Callie will rejoin us and we'll sort of wrap up the day. It's a huge, historic, and really important day.
And for people who don't
know, Boston and America's history.
Embrace Boston is, you want to explain what it is?
It's this beautiful statue that's memorial, not just to Martin Luther King Jr., but to Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta King, who most people, I think, continue to not know, met where, Marjorie?
They met in Boston.
They met in
Boston.
I kept
saying she was at the Boston Conservatory. She was at the New England Conservatory.
That is correct.
She was here studying music, and that's when they met.
Okay, so Tuesday we'll be back at the library. Next Friday we'll be on the Common for the dedication of the Embrace Memorial. So it's the tale of two insurrections, I guess you could say, in Washington. One 2 years ago today, when a violent mob charged the steps of the Capitol, trampling, assaulting Capitol police officers, as you know, later leading to some of them dying, smashing windows, calling for the murders of Pelosi and Pence. Another insurrection continues today, a different sort, as about 20 members of the GOP class in the House are refusing to budge, holding hostage the entire membership, the entire Congress, actually, over who to make the next speaker. Marjorie Taylor Greene, we don't quote her much. She was one of the insurrectionist voters in 2020, is calling them destructionists. Well, the number is 877-301-8970 to call or text us. As I said, 2 years since the original January 6th, have we learned anything? 2 years in, is our democracy any safer than it was 2 years ago? And when you're contemplating that question, I think you're mostly aware that the leader of the insurrection, Donald J. Trump, is still an unindicted man. 877-301-8970. You and I were talking briefly on the phone this morning before you came down to the library. You and I have a disagreement. I would say, with the exception of the January 6th committee's terrific work, the vast majority of the American people have moved on. There are, and the media, by the way, we've made the same mistake as part of the media. The fact that 118 House members who voted not to certify the election results from 2020, which I would argue is supporting an insurrection, are still there and are never mentioned as insurrectionists during all this McCarthy chaos is really a pox on all of our houses. I think people have moved on from the fact that our democracy almost fell thanks to the leadership, and I put that in quotes, of a former president of the United States.
Well, you know what I didn't know until I read a couple of days ago in Axios that the Republicans had gotten rid of the metal detectors.
I didn't know it either.
Going in because there was concern about people bringing weapons, and I understand why, because there's a lot of weapon. Lauren Boebert loves to carry around guns, and so there was concern about those weapons being brought into the House chamber, and I get that completely. But they've gotten rid of the metal detectors, and they did it 3 days before the Capitol riot anniversary. I do think people are thinking about it, because I think people are going to jail. I mean, they're certainly reading about the guy that got 10 years, you know, for Thomas Webster, that former New York City police officer. He got 10 years. This other guy from Tennessee, the guy that dragged Michael Fanone, the police officer we've seen over and over again on television, nice looking guy with a small beard, gray hair, small beard. He was pulled down the steps into this angry Trump mob that beat him up and attacked him with a stun gun. He got, I think, 7.5 years in prison. So there's some pretty significant.
Who's talking about that exactly? I must have missed that. Other than the day when he was sentenced. Who? I mean, can you focus on the thing I mentioned a minute ago? You and I both quote Margaret Sullivan a lot. Uh-huh. Somebody we admire, former ombudsperson at the New York Times, Washington Post, media critic, etc., said every time you talk about this whole deal and what's going on in the House and beyond, you have to mention that the majority of these people led an attempted insurrection. When was the last time you've seen on any of the networks or NPR that you listen to mention of the fact that more than a majority of the people voting for the next speaker are people who voted essentially for an insurrection? They voted to undo the results of a Democratic election in 2020.
Well, you may be right. We haven't seen much about that, but we have seen certainly about the continuing pursuit of people, including a 68-year-old OBGYN from Massachusetts.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, a woman who was accused of punching a police officer in the face. She just got arrested right before Christmas, and she's going to face charges too. Most of the charges are just for trespassing. They're misdemeanors. But there's 280 charges involving assaulting cops, and 100 of those with a dangerous weapon. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing at the fact that it doesn't matter what we're talking about. And there is a segment of our listeners / viewers on YouTube who only care about criticizing my look. So let's get to the. Here's on YouTube. Starlight on Jim's shirt. What does this mean? Well, the answer is figure it out. Next one. Is Jim going for the scruffy, unshaved, painfully hip look? No, I am not. I'm not on television at the moment, and as a result, you don't have to shave every day. End of discussion. Starlight is this wonderful pop-up theater venue in Central Square. My younger daughter has worked there from time to time, and it's a sweatshirt from there. In any case, 877-301-8970.
The show began. I went to the restrooms there, and I brushed my hair and put my lipstick on. I'd like to point that out, Jim.
Okay, fine. Now, can I say one more thing, a really positive note? I'm sure it was strategic, but also really meaningful, I think. On the second anniversary of January 6th, against the backdrop of 12 o'clock, the 12th vote to elect a speaker, which will fail in all likelihood, the Democrats, and I don't know if any Republicans were there, led by Hakeem Jeffries, who is the Democrats' leader, held a moment of silence on the Capitol steps for the officers who were wounded during January 6th.
That's right.
I thought it was a beautiful tribute. And I'm sure, again, there was a strategic point to juxtapose it with the chaos in the House and the fact that so many House members have been, Republicans, have been so disrespectful of the men
cops
and women, of whom lost their life, some of whom were just seriously injured.
Well, I think
it was great.
Worth recalling before we get to the phone calls at 877-301-8970. You can also text us at that number. That Officer Sidnick, who died shortly after the January 6th attack, his mother and his brother were there when members of the House were honoring these police officers. And when it came time for them to go up to Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy and shake their hand, they blew right by both of them and refused to shake their hand. And this is the guy that is on on the 12th ballot now or 11th ballot, trying to become the Speaker of the House. So, you know, I can see why it would be hard to vote for Kevin McCarthy, frankly.
Can I say one more thing before you get to the number? It's about time, in my opinion, not that I'm involved in any of the grand jury work. It's time for this Department of Justice, 2 years out, to act on Donald Trump or anybody else who they believe committed crimes. federal crimes as a result of an attempt to overturn an election, the documents, the insurrection, whatever it is time. 877-301-8970. It's the second anniversary of the January 6th attempt at insurrection. What does it mean to you 2 years out? Do you think about it at all? Is our democracy any safer than it was? That Electoral Reform Act did pass and is now law. That'll make it impossible for a future vice president to do what Donald Trump wanted Mike Pence to do. I guess that is progress. Louise in Boston, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
If you said, can you hear me, we can. Great. Yes.
Oh, great. Fine. I wanted to say that, yes, we are much better off because the Republicans have in the House have really shown what Republicans have been looking for, a certain segment of Republicans, which is to defy government, to destroy the meaning of government, to create chaos, and to bring down democracy. And now people are seeing in actual time that they now are not prepared to govern. That was never their interest, really. There's a group of them who really were insurrectionists from the time they ever heard about Trump.
Yeah, can I tell you something, Louise? I wish I shared your optimism. And I know people like Ayanna Pressley said the same thing to us the other day. The American people have a painfully short attention span, like a gnat, for example. I mean, they criticized Democrats, for just as one example, for attempting to, quote, pack the Supreme Court and seem to forget that it is Mitch McConnell, the Republican, who packed the Supreme Court, beginning with the failure to even hold a hearing for Merrick Garland. So I sure as hell hope you are right, but I worry that the sins of any politicians are forgotten painfully quickly by the American people. And as I say, I just hope you're right. 877-301-8970.
Well, you know, what a couple of people pointed out, including Brian Stelter, who had that great Reliable Sources show every Sunday, which is no longer hosted by him anymore.
He's now at Harvard, right? Shorenstein
Yeah, I think
Center?
So. Yeah. And he wrote a piece in The Globe saying that one of the things that's been interesting about this whole endless debate in the House is that regular C-SPAN is in there with their cameras. Usually it's very regulated. Mm-hmm. Government cameras that show somebody standing up there giving a speech and almost the empty house beside it. This time you're getting to see sort of the action in the House. And it's sort of, if you're a political wonky type, it's pretty interesting seeing people chatting. I mean, there's a lot about what was AOC talking to Matt Gaetz about the other day and Marjorie Taylor Greene chatting up Kevin McCarthy. So you're seeing them, you know, gossiping and chatting about the House. It should be that way all the time. The idea that you're just going to have the House decide what the shot is all the time is a problem.
Yeah, well,
I think
know what the problem is, though, is the point was made by Chip Royer, one of the Republicans, the other day. The members are never in the House having those conversations. So it doesn't matter where the cameras are. If you're not in the House,
well, I think
you're
that
not
would
on the
be,
floor.
I think that would be lovely for people to see, the emptiness of the
not
House
there. Oh, that's
day
a good point.
After day after
that's a good
day.
Point. Let's go to Bob in Pembroke. You're on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good morning. Aside from the fact that work that needs to be done can't get done, I'm not that concerned about the dissension in the speakership election. I think the efforts to work it out is actually a good thing to observe.
Why is that? Why?
Well, that's what democracy is about, isn't it? Compromise, efforts to work together, see if we can reach consensus. I mean, that's democracy in action.
Well, I would argue there's no compromise. Through 3 days of embarrassment.
Yeah, I think that has been the party line coming from Fox News and coming from conservatives. That's the line. This is democracy in action. This congresswoman from Florida said, I couldn't believe it. She said,
Salazar, is that who you
said? Yeah, I mean, I thought, oh, my God. She said, well, you know, we're much better than like Nicaragua and Venezuela other countries that are struggling. I mean, Bob, with all due respect, this hasn't happened for 100 years, more than 100 years at this point, I think, because we're passing the 1923 mess. And it doesn't show compromise. It shows a lack of compromise for nothing that has anything to do with what the American people want. You know, I think it makes us look silly.
Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, well, that leads to my second point that I think our democracy is at risk at the moment, and I think for many reasons, not the least of which is the media. I am not a Fox fan, Fox News fan, and I think Rupert Murdoch really has has done a lot of the damage to our democracy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that's something that we really need to think about.
Bob, thank
Bob,
you for the call.
Thank you for the call. And I'm glad you brought up Rupert Murdoch, because there seems to be a schism on Fox News now. Sean Hannity seems to be the guy that is saying, let's have the moderates rise to the fore. And Tucker Carlson is, let's just burn it all to the ground kind of guy.
Didn't you when Murdoch bought the Herald centuries ago, weren't you assigned to interview him?
Yeah.
How was that?
He came in when he bought the Boston Herald. That was many, many years ago. And I got to follow him around. And, you know, I was very nervous because it was Rupert Murdoch. And I'm like 25 years old. And
how
I'm
did he treat you,
around.
By the way?
Well, he finally told me, okay, enough already. That's what he finally said. But he came in with his then wife, Anna Murdoch, and he came in with the people that these British guys were going to take over the paper. And we toured the he toured the Herald, and I followed around. And they have – people may know this, that they saw on Morrissey Boulevard, if you could, when you drive down the expressway, when the Globe still had the big presses
sure.
inside where you look
I
at those
that.
Windows, those massive presses.
That was great.
And the Herald, because we never had any money, used to get the throwaway presses from the Boston Globe. So the Globes were these big yellow, bright things, all painted, looking lovely. And the Heralds were these grungy black things that were full of soot. There were always fires down in the press room and stuff. And I remember walking through the press room with him. I don't know what he said, but it looked like we needed new presses. Let's put it that way.
Let's go to Sheila in Rhode Island. You're on Boston Public Radio on the second anniversary of January 6th. Hey.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We can.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay. Oh, I guess you can't hear us. Let's put Sheila on hold. We'll try to see if we can work that kind of thing out. 877-301-8970. David in Somerville.
CNN is apparently reporting that there were no Republicans at the memorial.
None. Well, that's not a huge surprise.
I mean, how can you not show up at a memorial to the police officers that day that were just outnumbered and surrounded?
Well, because it's led by a Democrat, you obviously can't cross that line, I guess, is the notion. David from Somerville, I'll do the reverse. Can you hear me, David?
I can, I hope.
Excellent. So what's up?
Well, I agree with you that it's not great what it says for democracy. The only slight bit of optimism I can think of is, it to me, it's reminiscent of 1994 when the Republicans grossly overplayed their hand, and the Newt Gingrich revolution came back to haunt them in 1996 because they maybe showed their true colors a little too much. And maybe part of the hope is that the result of this, again, is that people see what's really happening and in the next election remember it. I agree with you, Jim, that they don't have a long memory for things, but it certainly happened in 1994.
That is a brilliant point, and I wish I had thought of that. David, I'm really glad you called. That was a perfect example of what that caller was suggesting, and I hope you're right, and I hope that 1994 is replicated. Thanks, David.
Ted from Marshall has been sending us poems, Jim.
Yes?
And I think we should read one today.
Well, why don't you?
You ready?
No.
Have we ever seen anything weaker than Kevin's mad quest to be speaker? Though well-versed in sedition, he skipped first grade addition. Now Congress has never been bleaker.
Oh, that's actually excellent.
Thank you, Ted, from Marshfield.
That was terrific.
Yeah, we love
actually.
That.
Marjorie, this is where I say to you, we got to take a break.
Oh, we got to take a break.
Got to take a break.
Okay. We're talking about...
How is it that I always know we have to take a break, and you don't know we have to take
a break? I don't
know,
because I'm reading the text messages, Jim. That's
Marjorie, we have to take a break.
We have to take a break. Okay, we're talking about another one of Jim's obsessions, because that's what we always do. We talk about Jim's obsessions. And he's upset because he thinks everybody's ignoring the second anniversary of January 6th.
Because they
are. I don't
are.
Think that's true at all. But anyway, that's what he thinks. And the chaos is echoed in the unfolding drama in the House as they vote and vote and vote for a speaker in the House. 877-301-8970 is the number. You can call us or text us at that number. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library, and we are streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews.
You just heard our colleagues say what matters to you. What matters to me is the clam chowder from the Newsfeed Cafe is fabulous.
Oh, good. Okay.
It is really, really good.
I should get it for lunch then?
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GVHnews. We're talking about the second anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol and a different kind of insurrection going on amongst the Republicans in terms of the selection of a speaker? Have we learned anything? Is democracy safer than it was when it was almost undone in 2021? 877-301-8970. Here is Kevin McCarthy. By the way, I think everybody knows there was Kevin McCarthy, and then there was Kevin McCarthy at Mar-a-Lago. Here he is. This is a leaked audio of Kevin McCarthy, then the Republican leader, on a call with House Republican other leaders. This is 4 days after the insurrection.
I don't want to rush things. I want everybody to have all the information needed. I've had it with this guy. What he did is unacceptable. Nobody can defend that, and nobody should defend that.
Well, the only person who is defending it is the same guy who said it was indefensible. He's talking, of course, about the behavior of then-President Trump on January 6th.
Okay, we have a very upset texter.
Sure.
Sally from Newbury. She asked where the nihilistic – is it nihilistic or
yeah.
not?
Yeah. I think – well, I don't know what it is, actually. It may be nihilistic.
Nihilistic,
sure.
Whatever it is. Nihilistic or nihilistic. Anarchic destructionists like M.T. Green – that's Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz – are going to get paid by the government they so obviously abhor and are so happy to burn down, typical of the hypocrisy they embody in every fiber of their deplorable – beings.
Well, people should – I know this is what, not what Sally from Newbury is referencing, but just so people understand current context, they're on different sides of this Kevin McCarthy thing. Marjorie Taylor Greene, much to the amazement of most because she's been made promises by McCarthy, is an ardent supporter of McCarthy and actually has been trashing her extremist colleagues for not being on board the McCarthy train.
Yes, and we discussed this morning. You thought that this was – I was making much ado about nothing, and
what's
maybe
that?
I am. But there is some speculation now that McCarthy has made so many concessions that moderate Republicans may just be unable to accept those concessions, because the assumption is even if they move away from McCarthy, that those concessions are going to remain with the speaker that comes in second. So I don't know.
I would say that they don't give a damn. I think they care. It's sort of the discussion we were having yesterday about even if the people in Santos's district had known about all the lies, would they have voted for him? He had an R after his name. Probably would have won the damn election anyway. Sheila in Rhode Island, we'll give it a second try. Welcome.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. We can.
Okay, good. I just wanted to say that for me, January 6th was the domestic version of 9/11. 9/11 upended our lives, January 6th similarly, and I have to say that if I look and see how the world has changed since 9/11, I think the same thing domestically is going to be play out over the next 20 years in this country.
Well, I have to say, I worry that there could be those kinds of outcomes if this thing is not nipped in the bud. And thank you, Sheila, for making the call. Did you see Adam Kinziger on Anderson Cooper last night?
I missed him.
He is the former congressman from Illinois. He obviously he didn't run for re-election. He was one of the two Republican members of the January 6th committee, very critical of Trump. He is suggesting that the thing we talked to Ayanna Pressley about the other day, Democrats joining with five or more moderate Republicans to elect a Republican speaker who is not a lunatic, would be a great healing thing for this country. And in the abstract, it absolutely would be. It'd still be a Republican speaker, but not someone who's an extremist or an insurrectionist. It's just not happening. I mean, it's not happening. That person couldn't rule the other 200 and some Republicans. So as noble as the notion is, it's not going to happen.
John from Somerset thinks someone should nominate Liz Cheney.
That's right. You don't have to be a member of the House to do that.
Yeah. And Melissa from Rhode Island says, boy, oh boy, Jim is snarky today. It's Friday, Jim. The week is almost over. Take a deep breath. Be nice to the callers.
You know, I'll try to be nice to the callers. A couple of things about Liz Cheney. And while I think all of us, I know Marjorie and I, and I'm sure most of you,
yep,
praise her brilliant performance during the January 6th hearings, there are three things that bear mention. One, she voted with Donald Trump 93% of the time.
She did.
Two, she reportedly, according to the Washington Post and the New York Times, is responsible for a Christian nationalism not being in the final report, which was central to a lot of the insurrection. And number three, reports are the reason Ginny Thomas is not mentioned in her insurrectionist behavior, the wife of Clarence Thomas, is not mentioned in the executive summary, or I think the report itself, I'm not sure about that, is because of Liz Cheney blocking on the committee any mention of Thomas because of her loyalty to the Thomas family.
Well, you know, there's an interesting story about Americans becoming less and less enamored or involved in organized religion that mm-hmm. I read somewhere yesterday. Mm-hmm. And it was saying how people are moving away from everything, Catholicism, Protestantism. But 99% of the GOP in Congress is Christian. 99%.
I'm not. Are you surprised? Well, I guess that is really. That's pretty surprising.
I would have thought there would have been maybe a few more Buddhists, a few more Jews.
Well, 99% are Christian, and about 55% are insurrectionists. So that's a.
You know who says she has no religion?
Who?
Kristen Sinema.
Is that really true?
Yeah, she's one of the only ones. She's unaffiliated.
She is unaffiliated in more ways than one. Roger and Marblehead, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I just thought you'd be happy to hear that I just heard from the Guinness Book of World Records that Kevin McCarthy has set a new world record for public humiliation in a given week.
That is really upbeat news. Thank you for sharing that, Roger. Go ahead.
I knew you'd be happy to hear that. And in honor of that, I understand that President Biden is going to rename the Capitol cellar as the debasement.
Well, you know, Roger, don't you wonder about that? I mean, he puts on a good face. He seems to be chatting and laughing and smiling and all this kind of stuff. But he's got to go home at the end of the day, or wherever he goes at the end of the day. I mean, it is.
Can I say to both you and Roger something politely?
What?
Are you kidding? This is a guy who on January 6th said, I'm done with Trump. On January 10th says Trump's responsible for the insurrection. And a week later,
Jim,
he's kissing his ass
at
Mar-a-Lago.
Like
that's not humiliating.
In high school, if you're running for class president and you get trounced over and over and over and over again.
What's more humiliating, pulling out and being a backbencher or continuing to fight in the very narrow hope that you win at the end of the day and no one remembers the humiliation? I'd say the alternative is even more humiliating.
I think the alternative is more humiliating, but I don't know. I don't know if he's gonna ever get there. Roger, thank
you. Roger, you made our day, though, despite my comments. Thank you for calling. We appreciate it.
Just here's Stephen Marlborough. Just like we saw 2 years ago when a couple of Democrats stopped everything, how long will we watch the Republicans not do their jobs? Actually, I'm not sure what he means. Who are the two Democrats that stopped everything 2 years ago?
Sinema and Manchin, your two favorite senators.
Oh, my God. Sorry. Whoops.
Whoops. We have time for one more if you want to tell us who we should talk to. There he is.
David in Waltham. Thank you for calling.
Hi, David. Welcome.
Hi. Besotted listener here.
Hi.
It's going to sound a little stilted. I'm going to read a text exchange I had with a friend. We were talking about what should be the consequences following this. I was opting for a harsher version of the consequences to Trump, et cetera. This has been churning in me as we work through these circumstances. My dad gave 6 years of his life, 3 as a POW, to fighting fascism in Europe. After leaving Poland in 1969, August of 1939, he saw his mother once in 1977, never saw his father again, and lost his homeland. To the extent that I detect present-day echoes of the European experience, I feel uneasy. That's how I feel on a everyday basis. And to hear anybody say that we're ready to get beyond this is extremely demoralizing.
David, we appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. We really do. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you very much, David, for the call. We are moving on. We're going to be talking up next with Lydia Downey. Lydia Downey, she's the president and CEO of Pine Street Inn. We're going to talk to her about what Governor Healey's plan is for the homeless tragedy in this city and around the country, what Joe Biden's plan is, as well as her efforts to build supportive housing for people who are without homes in neighborhoods that are not very welcoming. She's next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library and streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. We'll be back here on Tuesday. Next Friday, we won't be here. We'll be at the dedication of the Embrace, the tribute to Martin Luther King Jr., Coretta Scott King, and 60-plus local civil rights leaders. That's next Friday on the Com. We're joined now by one of Boston's greatest assets, Lyndia Downey. She is president and executive director of the Pine Street Inn. Lyndia, it's nice to see you.
You too. Yeah, thank you very much for coming in, Lyndia. So let's start out with our new governor, Maura Healey. She has put out a plan for housing, dealing with homelessness. What do you think of her plan?
Oh, I think she's on the right track. No question about it. I think she knows production's going to matter a whole lot. We don't have enough housing for anybody, frankly. The people we work with bear the biggest burden. We know she's a fan of supportive housing, which we're excited about. We had her over recently to a new building we're working on with Beacon Companies in the, right here in the Back Bay. And, you know, she understands, I think, the need for affordability and support for some people and just generally production. And not going to be easy, but I think she's thinking about it the right way.
You know, and she's also, as we mentioned the other day, I can't remember with whom we were having this discussion. I wasn't aware of it. She's segregating out housing. Was it Michael Curry? Who are we talking about? As a separate secretariat.
That's right.
That's more than symbolically important, don't you think?
Absolutely. It needs its own secretariat, and it needs to have a statewide view and be focused on nothing but housing.
You know, when I'm looking down some bullet points on her housing plan, number two in the list we have here is she directed the finance secretary to conduct an audit of state-owned land and properties. That's what almost every new elected official does, whether you're a mayor, woo, or whatever. And I say to myself, I don't mean to be critical of her. She just took office a day ago. Why hasn't that been done about 1,000 years ago? If you own property and you're a trumpeter, not you, a leader, an elected leader, of more affordable housing, go to where you'll have fewer obstacles to building affordable housing.
I think the obstacles are still out there, even if you have state-owned property.
Why do you have a weird smile on your face?
Because I just think the issue around NIMBY, no matter where you go, Jim, it's real, it's alive, it's here in Boston, it's in the suburbs, it's in Western Mass, it's on the Cape. And if you're not going to tackle that and you're not going to tackle the zoning constraints that kind of contribute to NIMBYism, it's still going to be an uphill climb.
Well, you know, let's talk about that for a minute. We're going to talk to you in a minute. A new book about Jim O'Connell is coming out by the great writer Tracy Kidder. And Jim O'Connell has been a longtime physician dealing with health care for the homeless. But he mentioned in the story that Shirley Leung did that, you know, Mass and Cass gets a lot of publicity. But that's a unique deal down there where a lot of people are dealing with drug addiction and big-time substance abuse problems, where so many people that are homeless are people that got evicted. They're regular Joes and Janes, moms and dads who got evicted. So talk about that misunderstanding about who is homeless.
You know, I think the press around Mass Cass, Jim's right, has created this impression that that's all that's happening around homelessness, when it's not. It's a subset of folks that are homeless, but it's more complicated than that. A lot of it is about addiction on Mass Cass. You know, there's people every day getting housed. Most people are not on Mass Cass. Most people are in shelter or staying elsewhere on the street in Boston. And, you know, to Jim's point, he and I have talked a lot about this. Sometimes people lose their housing because they get sick, even if they have insurance. You get sick enough, you lose your job, you can't pay the rent anymore. And that's not unusual for us to see that. And as people get older, We tend to see it more with people who are aging, and it's going to be the next wave of homelessness across the country, not just here in Boston.
Well, you know, also, by the way, before you continue with that, can I just say people should read a story in the Globe, and I'm sure I'm going to brutalize her name. Alexa Gagoz, is that how you pronounce it? Her piece was how a hardworking middle-class family spiraled into homelessness.
That
is so on point.
Mom and dad, they both had jobs, both making $80,000 a year, and they I think they had to move because the person wanted the landlord needed their apartment for family. And that's another big reason. Or people have been living in a place, East Boston, we talk about this all the time. Mm-hmm. People have been living there for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and suddenly the landlord says, hey, I can make a fortune here, turn this into a condo or whatever, and then they can't afford the rents anywhere.
And we don't have any way to stop that, frankly.
Yeah.
It really is, the speculation is out there in the market. The counter to that is you've got to build affordable units because we're losing reasonable units in the market every day.
You know, in addition to Healy, I want to stay on, well, at least state government, before we get to some news that I was unaware of till recently about what Biden has announced about homelessness on the federal level, which sounds like you wrote the damn speech from at least what he focuses on. I don't know if we've ever talked to you about rent control before. If we have, I forget. My apologies. We all know that Mayor, she doesn't call it rent control. She calls it rent stabilization. And I believe on this show and others, Maura Healey, Attorney General and candidate for governor, has said, I think quite clearly, she supports a local option rent control bill, not one that mandates it across the state, but where individual communities could vote through their legislative body or whatever. Assuming that were to happen, and assuming Boston were to adopt it, and by the way, a little piece of history for those who forget, when it was abolished, and I think in 1994 on the ballot, the three communities that had rent control voted to keep it, and the 348 which didn't voted to get rid of it, and they prevailed.
And just as a quick aside, I lived in Brookline for a long time, and when I was first in Brookline, Beacon Street was full of rent control apartments with single moms and kids. And so you had a real mix of
Cambridge, same deal.
And then almost instantaneously, they all disappeared from my kids' school. I mean, you noticed how everything went just through the roof.
So if the legislature passes this bill, which is iffy, and Healy honors her commitment, which I think is probably not iffy, does that make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it'll make a difference in Boston. There's no question about it. I mean, we're seeing it across the state. We know we're seeing it across the country. But Boston's been particularly hard hit, right? We don't have enough production. We're still a city where people want to be. And it's not that I don't think landlords should be able to raise rent, but it's got to be reasonable. It's got to be that working people can still afford a small rent increase so landlords can, you know, cover their increased costs. So, you know, I hope they do give it back to local control. That vote years ago was not a level playing field at all, and it hurt, in my opinion, it hurt Boston and some of our bigger cities more than other smaller towns.
Couldn't agree with you more. So let's, before we come back to Boston, talk about the current state of affairs as winter is about to begin, which I assume is the most trying time for you and all the people with whom you work. I wasn't being facetious before. When I read this announcement that the Biden administration made the other day, right at the center of the thing is the thing that you've been educating us about it for months, supportive housing. That is what he's talking about as his centerpiece, right?
Absolutely. I think we know that I think I've said this before. Lots of people move through homelessness quickly, right? 80% of our guests are gone within a couple of months. We're a bit of a safety net. They bounce back out. They get some help from us. Sometimes they get no help from us. They just need a place to stay while they figure things out. For the group that can't move out of homelessness, that are stuck, the chronically homeless, supportive housing we know works. It's not perfect, just better than what we have. And this plan really puts a lot of emphasis on supportive housing. It talks about the support in supportive housing, not just building the building. How do you keep people housed?
What is the support? We ask this every time you hear, but for those who are new to the subject matter, Shirley Leung wrote a beautiful piece about a Mr. Jimenez. You might want to tell that story. It's up to you. But tell us what supportive housing is in the real world for people who need it.
So it's housing that's affordable to people at the very lowest income. And when I say very low income, people that have income, usually a fixed income of $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, maybe $8,000 a year, who also need some support. They might be struggling with substance use, mental health. They might have medical issues. And that's becoming more and more, as I said earlier, an issue for us in housing as we try and keep people housed. And so we have usually some overnight staffing in the house. We have some case management. We work really closely with Healthcare for the Homeless and Jim's team because some of their nursing staff are in helping us keep our folks housed and keep them healthy enough so they can hold on to their housing. It's been a long time coming, Jim, to be honest. It's not that the federal government hasn't been talking about it. It just hasn't been a comprehensive package. There's been, you know, capital money but not enough support. This, in theory, should help pull those two pieces together.
And you've built hundreds of units. I think you have, control over 850
units? Yeah, about 850 now, a couple hundred in the pipeline.
You know, explain to people, we mentioned before that the homelessness that you see on Mass and Cass is different than the homelessness of people that are in supporting housing who have a house. So I know some people think the rules are too stringent. I know you have to clean your room and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Well, that's not a bad idea to clean the room. I'd be a little upset.
I'm not sure that's what they were talking about stringency.
To clean the room. Well, you know, I mean, a lot of us are slobs. But in any case, the rules that are kind of in place for supportive housing, so you're not getting, you know, a wild scene down outside the supporting housing on Morrissey Boulevard.
Yeah, so I think this is a fine line to try and explain to people. People do get screened into supportive housing, but we try and screen as little as possible, right? Because what you want to do is get people who haven't had access to housing to be able to get into housing, right? So you don't want to, you want to screen everybody in as much as you can, and then you want to bring support to them. You have some rules, but the point of this is to have rules that are flexible enough to work with people on what they need. And despite the room cleaning, as you and I both know, just doesn't happen the way you and I probably, or at least we'd like to think, right? It's all a matter of how do you work with people on a one-on-one and deal with everything from, you know, whatever crisis it might be to getting them stable and steady enough so maybe they don't need supportive housing anymore.
You know, we talk about this to you, ad nauseum with you too, but I think it's important to revisit it every time because it's a continuing issue as you try to expand. You got a couple of projects going on. My understanding is the one in JP, you've overcome my paper. Well, that's the right verb. The community concern around parking and some other things, you struck a deal. There's still concern in Dorchester. I have to say, if I lived across the street from the place, I'd probably have some concerns until you addressed them too. Forget the lunatic ones, you know what I'm talking about. The legit ones, I assume you'd agree a lot are legit too. Tell us what some of them are and why you can allay the concerns, the fears of people who are operating in good faith.
You know, I think we hear from people about safety. Is it going to make my neighborhood less safe? Is there going to be more of a criminal element in my neighborhood? I think we hear quality of life stuff. Will people be sitting on my front stoops, smoking and drinking and things like that? So, I mean, those are the typical things we hear.
So what do you say to them?
Well, on the safety piece, you know, these larger units, we have on-site security. And we work really hard with our tenants to say, look, you live in a neighborhood now. You've got other tenants. This is different than shelter. You got to be a neighbor. And some people get it, some people don't. We got to work harder with them on it. But bottom line is, once you have a place to stay, you're not going to hang out on somebody's steps to have a smoke and a drink, right? Because you've got a place to go now and do it. And that sounds so silly and elemental, but that's reality. You could drive by any of our properties right now, and there's nobody sitting on the steps doing anything. I mean, it's a cold day, but you could drive by in August. And, you know, people are going about their business doing their thing.
Well, what I've said to you before, I don't know where I visited. I think it was Jamaica Plain. But the idea of having that big kind of central area where people can hang out with couches, watch TV, have, like, a dinner for more than a few people. I mean, I think that's such a great idea, too, because, you combat lonesomeness
exactly
that way.
I think one of the hard things when you move out of housing into housing when you've been homeless for a long time, and especially if you come off the street, is you are really lonely. Your community that was out there isn't with you, and we're going to tell you you can't bring your community with you into your unit. I mean, it's one of the things people struggle with. Can my friend come and sleep on the floor because he's staying out? Can't do that. So you really have to help people figure it out and create a new sense of community, and you've got to have some community space, and you got to have enough community activities. You can't force people to participate, but enough so they'll start to engage a little bit more.
Yeah, I hate to, not hate, I want to return to the guy that Jimenez, who was profiled by Shirley, talked about exactly what you two are talking about. Isn't part of her piece that it was his 70th birthday, and he was feeling a little lonely, actually, on his 70th birthday, and his social worker or whatever the title is, and his neighbors threw a little surprise 70th.
Yeah.
I mean, how beautiful is that?
Yeah. Astor Netter, who's our case manager over at that house, she's amazing, amazing. And I got to give her a shout out. But, you know, she knows the tenants really well. She knew his birthday was coming up. She knew he was feeling a little blue and said to some of the other tenants, let's do a little birthday party. But, you know, that house in particular is a number of older guys there. You know, they have a regular domino. They're down there playing dominoes all the time. The chess set is set up. Pretty competitive on the domino front, I will say. But, you know, this is just such a different life than they had 3, 4, 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. So why is it with the prices through the roof and all our landlords needing the apartments for their kids or whatever, why is it that overall the numbers are declining? I would have thought just the opposite.
Yeah. So we saw some numbers from HUD soon after that Biden report came out. There's an annual report called the AHAR, Annual Report to HUD. Massachusetts actually did pretty well. We made it into the top 5 states where the numbers went down the most in the past 2 years, which given COVID is pretty remarkable. And then we made it into the top 5 states for the biggest reductions over the past 15 years. Wow. So we're making some headway, and a lot of it is supportive housing. A lot of it's targeting people. A lot of it's trying to target the supply. And I think, you know, this past administration has worked hard to get families out of hotels and motels. I mean, we're seeing, unfortunately, that go the other way at the moment. But I think there's been a real concerted effort, and you've got to counter the high rent, Marjorie, with the production and the other pieces, and getting the systems better lined up.
So winter's on the horizon, unfortunately, for all of us, not just people without places to live. What are the kinds of things people can do who want to help? I mean, in addition to donating money, and tell us the website as always, but in addition to donating money, which obviously is always welcome and needed, what are the kinds of things people of goodwill can do to help your work?
You know, we're still collecting winter hats, gloves, socks. Never have enough of those, frankly.
Where do they bring them? Do they bring
them?
You
just bring them down to Pine Street. Okay. You can go on the website and
which is?
PineStreetInn.org, okay. www.PineStreetInn.org. Go on the website and, you know, one of our staff will get back to you. You know, staples of food you don't think about, things like cereal and stuff that, you know, it's expensive and people don't tend to think about that first, but cereal, coffee, love that kind of stuff, any staples like that. We're doing about 1,800 meals a day, and, you know, it every little bit helps.
You know those Bombas socks where you buy one, you get one free?
Yes.
Is that really happening? Do you
yeah, we have. We do. No, we do. We did. We got some a couple of months ago.
You did?
Yep. And,
They're great socks.
They're nice socks. They're nice socks, and I want to say the Patriots were down, and they brought some as well. So we love socks. I mean, this is back to the early days of, you know, when Jim O'Connell and I first started this, my first job at Pine Street was working with volunteers and donors to get clothing, and number one on the list was white socks.
Yeah.
White
really
socks.
True. Yeah. Well, you know, because they're expensive socks. And I thought, and they say you buy one, and then they donate one pair. And I thought, are they really donating? So I'm glad they're really donating. That's good.
So a couple of things coming up. February 12th, I think you're part of this coalition. Mm-hmm. This is this winter walk thing. Yep. They were kind enough to ask Marjorie me to emcee it again. This is a Copley place right around the corner, 9 a.m. on Sunday. They try to pick the coldest day of the year, they predict. Last year they came pretty close, by the way. It was brutal.
Yeah.
February 12th, you're part of this deal, are you not?
Absolutely. We have a winter walk team every year. You know, it was started by Paul English, the amazing Paul English.
And who contributed the first $1 million to the Embrace Memorial, by the way.
Yeah. That's right, and who's been out on our van quite a few times.
Oh, he has.
Amazing, amazing human being. But, the walk, it's either raining, snowing, or freezing. I don't know what else to say. So you do get a feel for what people who live outside are feeling with. But I'd encourage people to get involved. It's a great way. It's not a long walk, but it's a really great way to help the homeless community in the city.
Jamie, can you get us that email address, if you don't mind, before the segment's over, winter walk?
Yeah, thank you. Tell us, too, a little bit about Jim O'Connell. Shirley just did a piece about him and Tracy Kidder, who wrote Mountains Beyond Mountains and Soul of a New
Old
Machine.
Farmer. Mountains Beyond Mountains being the Paul Farmer story.
Yes, the writer was Tracy Kidder. Yeah. Anyway, you know, the stories, we've heard it before. He was going to be at Pine Street for a year. Then I think he was going to go off and specialize in oncology or something. But he's still there, 30 years later. Tell us about what he does.
So Jim is unique in that he is, for a lot of us, our North Star, right? Everything we think about and we want to do and aspire to, Jim is doing. And it's not just what he does, it's how he does it. So Jim's really the doc for homeless people in the city. Most of the past, really, 10 years, he's been focused on people who stay out. Still does some work in shelter, but mostly he's focused on street folks. And he's on our van at least one night a week with our outreach team and doing everything from, you know, I've watched Jim literally change bandages on the street. I've watched him get people a bed in a hospital. We've worked with him on getting people housed and then making sure once they get housed, they still have good health care. He's a miracle worker in so many ways.
When you go out on the
By the way, let me just interrupt to say, to hear one North Star describing somebody else as a North Star and one miracle worker describing another miracle worker, you are the most painfully humble person. You're in the top 10 anyway, Lyndia Downey, I have ever met in my life. You are.
Well, but Jim is shocked because it's a contrast. You know what I mean? Between
thank you very much.
But the thing is, to go out and change bandages at 2 o'clock in the morning when it's 15 degrees, mm-hmm. I mean, that's really something.
You know, I was out on the van with Jim a few years ago, and we picked up a guy who was a Vietnam veteran. He was a little small guy, and he had been what is called a tunnel rat in Vietnam. He was, because he was small, he was sent in the tunnels first, and basically you waited for somebody from the other side, right? Talk about trauma. And this young guy got on the van, and he wasn't young, actually, got on the van, and Jim and I were talking to him. And next to us was an older fellow who Jim and I knew well, who had stayed out a lot, and we finally convinced him to get in the van. And the older fellow got sick, nauseous, and Jim took out a paper bag and held it out. The guy vomited, and Jim didn't even, and we kept talking to this young Vietnam vet, this Vietnam vet, not young, he was an older guy, but talked about his life and his, the trauma and why he enlisted. He wasn't drafted, he enlisted, and and Jim got that veteran actually hooked up with the VA, so to get him some better health care, and he finally got housing. But I think about that night so often because didn't miss a beat. Not a beat.
Could you do that?
I knew what you were going to say to me. The answer is, no. Of course not.
No, I mean, I couldn't do that.
In any case, can I give two websites? The thing on February 12th that we were talking about, the Winter Walk, is winterwalk.org, and the website for the spectacular Pine Street Inn is pinestreetinn.org. I'm correct about that. Is that not right?
Yep.
Lyndia Downey, good luck in the winter. I know it's tough, and congratulations, as always, on your remarkable work and the work of all of your wonderful colleagues, by the way.
Okay, thank you very much, Lyndia, for coming in. We've been speaking with Lyndia Downey, who's the president and executive director of the Pine Street Inn. Up next, we're talking about the Buffalo Bills defenseman, Damar Hamlin, who is recovering.
Yeah. Talking this morning,
and talking,
I
after they took the tube out of his mouth. And the NFL and the decision about the game with GBH's Callie Crossy. She's up next. We're also going to talk about her up-close and personal moments working with Barbara Walters, the TV legend. That's right for the new news. Don't go away. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews and broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
I'm Jim Browdy, ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Callie Crossley joins us on the South Carolina Supreme Court decision striking down a 6-week abortion ban. Then Brandi Carlile headlined Mara Healey's inaugural ball last night, which included basketball-themed festivities at TD Garden. You may have heard she's the first openly gay governor and first elected woman governor in Massachusetts history. Media maven Sue O'Connell discusses this, why the Senate clerk was essentially sharing the podium with her yesterday, and Elon Musk losing more money than any other person in history.
I'm Marjorie Egan. The 20th Boston Celtic Music Festival is back at Club Passim next week. We'll be joined by co-organizers Sean Smith and Summer McCaw, with performances led by Maura Sean Scanlon and Adam Hendy. It's Live Music Friday down at the Boston Public Library on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Mr. Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number 2 of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday and every Friday at the Boston Public Library. No tickets needed. You can just kind of stroll down and come in and check it out. We are also streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews. And next Friday, we're going to have a special Boston Public Radio show from the Embrace Boston unveiling, and that is the wonderful memorial to Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta Scott King, and many famous Bostonians who were, or not so famous.
Famous, exactly.
Yeah. That were involved in the civil rights efforts here in the city.
By the way, we should thank people for coming, too. We appreciate people coming to the library on a rotten Friday. That was pathetic applause, by the way, but thank you for really embarrassing. That's a little bit better, but not really good. We're joined now by someone, actually, who's going to be joining us at the special BPR broadcast next Friday. GBH's Kelly Crossley. Kelly's the host of Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.76. She's also the host of Basic Black, which airs Fridays at 7:30. And you can hear her Kelly commentaries on Mondays for GBH's Morning Edition. Great to see you, Kelly. Hi.
Well, great to see both of you. Before we get started, I just want to give a shout-out to Heather, who's here.
Heather?
Heather, with her partner, both graduated from Wellesley.
Where are they?
And they drove from Maine because they listen to you every day.
Where the hell are they?
Yes.
Heather and partner, great to see you. Thank you for coming.
You are the most loyal Wellesley alum going.
Well,
absolutely,
you know,
true.
When you're the premier of women's college in the world, what can I say?
Okay. There was almost the president that went to Wellesley. Had you known that? I think you might have.
Yeah, I think Kelly was there for the big party.
Yeah, she was. Yes.
Yes, I do know that.
So most people do know about this 24-year-old defensive player for the Buffalo Bills,
yes.
DeMar Hamlin, who went into cardiac arrest on the playing field last week. Well, his condition, incredibly, almost miraculously, is improving, according to those close to him. Here's Jordan Rooney. He's a friend and is a de facto spokesperson for the family, talking with an NBC affiliate out of Buffalo yesterday.
Or not.
Or not.
Don't do nothing for that boy's mom.
Actually, that would be the wrong soundbite. So let's forget. By the way, yesterday we heard really good news that he was writing. He couldn't speak because
yes.
he was a feeding tube. And we understand this morning he actually is speaking now that they've removed the feeding tube, which is pretty incredible.
Well, the big issue there, of course, is the issue of brain damage.
Right.
And because you presume that when he went to cardiac arrest, he was without oxygen to the brain for a certain amount of time.
But you know what? He was extremely fortunate for a couple of reasons. The best medical folks right there. You know, those football teams have great medical people. He got rushed right into the hospital, and he's young.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to be 24 years old and in good shape, because you have to be, that helps.
You know, there's a bad news side to this in a minute, which is disgraceful, and obviously involves the NFL. We'll get to that in a minute. One of the heartening things, by the way, I assume all of us learned about this toy thing,
yes,
this little foundation.
So
and it was little. The goal, the fundraising goal for the year was $25,000.
$2,500.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay, that's even more.
Yes.
To give toys to kids in the neighborhood in Buffalo. So far, as of yesterday, I assume it's higher, they've raised a mere $7 million.
Isn't that great?
By the way, $18,000, $18,003, his number is three, from Bob Kraft from the Patriots for a whole variety of reasons. It's really a beautiful tribute, is it not?
And, you know, what I love about him is he's been so sincere, and when he put that together, he said he didn't want to forget where he came from and, you know, how hard it was for those kids to have toys. And, I mean, you know, he's 24 years old. He's a rookie. He's nobody big to be, you know, thinking in those terms of the way that he did.
Yeah.
And I just thought,
well, he's a sweetheart. You can tell when he was talking about his mother and father and how,
his little brother.
What does he do? He's out partying around town all the time. I'm sure he might do a little of that, but he's basically saying, you know, his mom and dad and his little brother are like the center of his life, and he does everything involving them. And I mean, he's just a sweetheart. So you want to get to the bad news after we get
The bad news is, we've discussed this before in a sport context, that unlike am I right about this? Yes, baseball and basketball, where you sign a contract, every dollar in your contract is guaranteed.
Yes.
Unless you're Deshaun Watson, who is, when he's not busy molesting women who are giving him massage, used to be a great football player, signing a $250 million contract. All these other contracts of people who are not superstars, you get a little bit of bonus. I think he got $160,000.
Yeah.
The other $4 million over 4 years is not guaranteed.
No.
And unless the NFL and or the Bills decide to bend the rules, he may have no income.
He will have no income. That is shocking to me.
So how about just announcing, like yesterday, his contract is guaranteed as of this minute. It's short money in NFL
for them
terms.
Particularly, you know, and it's a rookie contract, and he's just out. And he would not be at all eligible for pension.
That's right, because he hasn't had 3 years of service. Right.
So he has to have three. I didn't have any idea about this. So
they said he had $160,000 plus $825,000.
His first year's salary.
His first year's salary. And then, I mean, does he?
What happened?
Exactly.
So my question is the health insurance, as it usually is, tied to the job So if his contract is not guaranteed,
that's a great point.
What you know? I mean, he's having very expensive care at this moment.
Of course, and you know, also, not that I've lived this, but I've lived around it, and I know we all have the anxiety people have when they're not well, not even close to this unwell,
right,
about not having health insurance or right, how do you support X or Y. Why don't they just, even if they don't want to do it publicly, call his mother, call his father, call his friend, the spokesperson, and say, you know, on the QT, everything is guaranteed, including his health insurance, until he is well.
Right.
Period.
That's it. I'm with you. But
well, don't you think that's going to happen? I cannot imagine with all this publicity.
Listen, I was shocked that this story came out. So to me, if the story comes out and the guy that brought it out said, you know, I don't want to be a skunk at the garden party, but I think we should raise this, that was amazing to me. So I don't think a lot of us understood that.
Yeah, well, I didn't understand it either.
Marjorie, we had this discussion the other day. Don't you think it's going to happen? The NFL, I think quite clearly, had no intention to even call the game off until there was huge public pressure. And then they lied about having opposed. They wanted the players to go back in 5 minutes, and they chose, ultimately they had to withdraw that. So if they do this, they'll do it because they're forced to do it, not because it's the right thing to do. And I hope they are forced to do it, I guess, is the bottom line.
Yeah, because it's kind of well, it's worse than tacky. It's horrible.
Cruel.
You know? Cruel. That's
so,
right.
Yeah. So, Kelly Crossley, we've been talking a lot about abortion ever since the Dobbs decision from the federal government. But is I was reminded this morning the federal government put the decision back to the states. In South Carolina,
shockingly,
which is a pretty conservative state, what did the Supreme Court do there?
They ruled in a 3-2 decision to strike down what people may recognize as the Fetal Heartbeat and Protection Abortion Act. It's like all over. It's in state. It's been put forward in state legislatures all across the country. So 3-2 is still close, but they centered it around privacy and the woman's decision and said this is not right. Opponents to this decision said, well, it's not clearly stated in the Constitution, so they should have voted otherwise, particularly the two judges who voted not to support the strike down. But yet it happened. And that's pretty shocking. I'll just remind us all that Kentucky, pretty soon afterward, did the same thing, and everybody was surprised by that as well.
Yeah, a lot of the states where the legislatures were predominantly filled with conservative Republicans that wanted to get rid of this found that the people in the states that they represented were not so keen about getting rid of abortion protections. They're going to allow abortion in South Carolina up to 20 weeks. Mm-hmm. That's not quite to Roe v. Wade, but I think, you know, when you look at surveys, a lot of people are kind of squishy in those middle weeks, and I don't think 20 weeks is going to cause a big uproar.
I think we also should get back to the fetal heartbeat part is that this ruling was coming in before, as many experts will tell you, anybody knew they were pregnant.
Right.
So it's you're breaking the law. You don't even know you're pregnant. You
and the other thing is, you know, when I first heard fetal heartbeat, I thought, wow, that's amazing. You have a whole heart in 6 weeks. Well, you don't.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's just this electrical current that you can detect, but it's not a full-fledged heart that's operating at that point.
Can I ask you a question that relates to our earlier discussion? And this is my fear, not my wish. We talked at the top of the show whether anybody gives a damn about January 6th. I don't mean anybody. I mean as many people as should. I think they don't. You'd think they do. Women in particular rose up in these midterm elections. We've discussed it ad nauseum here, both in individual candidate races, ballot questions, constitutional amendments. In 2 years, will this continue to be as huge an issue as I think all three of us believe it should be?
Well, I'm going to amend what you said. It was not just women that rose up. It was young women and men.
You're right.
And so, yes, in 2 years, it will still
have
resonance.
Do you think that, Marjorie?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the FDA saying that you can give out abortion pills, or not give out, you can get abortion pills at CVS or Walgreens in the states where it's legal, is going to make it a lot easier for women to get abortions if their state forbids it. But there's still going to be, if you're in a state like Texas, you know, a big problem because it's such a huge state, and how are you going to get there? And so I think that's going to be the problem.
Well, I think it's all going underground, and I think when they announced that at least you could get the pills, those pills are going to go underground.
Yeah.
But the questions that still remain haven't been answered legally is if people who are funneling the pills to a state where it's illegal, are they liable for some kind of...
Well, the Biden administration this week, I hope I don't get this wrong, and please listen to me, my coworkers, to make sure I don't mislead people. The Biden administration, one of the agencies, issued a directive vis-a-vis the Postal Service mm-hmm. and the ability of the Postal Service to deliver the abortion pills in the jurisdictions where they are otherwise not legal. And their ruling was there's no liability on the part of the Postal Service, which is good for a step. Obviously, I assume that's going to be challenged. But yeah. The Biden administration appears to be doing whatever it can do by executive authority, by regulatory authority, to protect women as best they can in states where their leaders are not protecting women. So,
I'm just going to guess. I don't think the pills come through like, hey, pills.
Well, that's part of the argument.
You know,
yeah. How do they even know the
right,
Postal Service?
But you know what the other thing about this is that it's really disturbing? I mean, the abortion pills basically cause a miscarriage, right? And lots of women have miscarriages
that's
anyway.
Correct.
And miscarriages can be very scary.
Right.
If something goes wrong.
And life-threatening.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's, to me, that we shouldn't look at this as just, that's fine, because if you...
I mean the pills you're talking
about. If you have a medical pill-induced abortion, and then something goes wrong, and you go to the emergency room... Right.
Now everybody's liable.
Exactly.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
You know, are you going to be arrested at the emergency room? So all these questions are up in the air. And I think a lot of people would like the comfort of going to a clinic with a nurse and a doctor and not to be on your own in the bathroom.
That's correct. So you're still talking about, in the best of all possible worlds, if somebody is trying to take advantage of the situation, they have to be financially able to get themselves somewhere else so that they could have that as a backup, because otherwise it's all underground.
Right.
And you take your chances.
You take your chances.
As was pre-Roe.
Yeah.
Well, can we talk about somebody who sadly is not going to remain underground? I don't mean literally underground. Yeah. Bill Cosby. Here he is the week following Christmas, called in a radio talk show, which is what he did to us not too many years ago before all this arose. Mm-hmm. It was WWGH in Ohio, where he continued to claim he was innocent, obviously, of all charges of sexual assault, rape, etc. He also reveals he wants to be back on stage. Here he is.
And when I come out of this, I feel that I will be able to perform and be the Bill Cosby that my audience in person knows me to be.
So what's your reaction to this, and who's that audience exactly?
That's what I want to know. I really am curious. I mean, there's always some... He's had a core of supporters. If you recall, when he was going in and out of the courtroom, there were always people saying, you're right, Bill. We're with you, Bill. I don't think that core has gone away. As I've mentioned here before, I'm curious about the cadre of people around him who make up his team of supporters, you know, both legally and then who do the sort of PR stuff, because I'd like to know who they're, you know, they're more committed than just for a paycheck.
Yeah.
You know, they're there for something else, and I'm fascinated by that because I just don't get it. I don't know who the audience would be. Here's what I do know, which is, you know, what makes this so sad on many levels is, before we knew all this, the guy is incredibly funny and talented.
I know.
So I'm thinking he's thinking, hey, I still have that skill, and, you know, people will overlook this, and I'll just go out and have another career.
Wait, it's so funny. The exact same comment. We had Eric Deggans on yesterday from NPR's TV critic talking about Kamau Bell's, I can't remember the name of the four-part.
We have to talk about Bill?
Something like that. We're talking about Bill Cosby.
Yeah. It's four-part, which I know you've seen.
Wow,
I've only
fabulous.
Seen parts of it. Yeah,
oh, my God. So
it's a riot. This is not a particularly funny subject, obviously.
No.
Kamau Bell is a riot.
No, and it's normal.
In this series,
I encourage everybody to see this series because it is really eye-opening and well done, you know.
What was the point I was trying to make? Oh, that it's worth seeing.
I mean,
for those who didn't follow this as closely as they could, they understood the big picture. This drills into the small picture, and I think it deserves drilling. You know, Callie, in the last few days, we have spoken to people who admired Barbara Walters, who died last week from afar. We spoke to Eric Deggans yesterday, who interviewed her in 2008. We have not spoken to anybody yet
who worked with her. That's
and
right.
You would be that person.
I would be that person.
So tell us.
Well, first of all, I just can't say enough about what an incredible writer she was. Incredible. As you know, she began on the Today Show as a writer. So her skills were so sharp. We would go into the production meeting for that week, and if you were
producer, 2020,
this
right?
is 2020, ABC News 2020. So I was a segment producer for ABC News 2020. We'd go in, all of the teams. I just can't tell you how many people are in the room. There's a senior staff. There's a whole phalanx of writers okay? And they come with tape recorders. Why? Because they'd have the script. They're brilliant writers. They were hired at a network to write, and they'd hand it to her, and she'd pick it up and look at it and go, no. No, you know, I think what it should say is, and do a complete rewrite with no computer, no hesitation, periods, all of that. Da-da-da-da-da-da, yeah, period. Then da-da-da-da, and we're, you're sitting there in shock, and it would be light years better than what they wrote. Again, these are brilliant writers. It was amazing. So there was that. And then I had occasion, I didn't work with her. I work with Dr. Timothy Johnson regularly. Sure. But as it happened, I was a little bit involved with a case that came out of Boston. And you know she was a dog on a bone to get an exclusive. Mm-hmm. So I was called to the office because she thought I had a connection in Boston, which I did. I had one connection. And so there I am with the two secretaries in the pink office, both secretaries named Monica.
Pink?
Huge pink
That's
audience.
Pretty good.
Huge pink audience. It's pink office.
I did not know that.
Yes, beautiful. So you go in, and there, you know, it's very intimidating. And Kelly, yes. How do we get whoever this woman's name was? And I said, well, I really only know the lawyer. And so far the lawyer has just said to me, she's not going to speak. Uh-huh. What other connection do you have? I said, well, I know that the uncle kind of likes this old house. Maybe you can, okay, where is the uncle? And so what she would do is take every piece of information, and then she would write those people, write, call, write, but really it was the handwritten notes. And so you'd think, wow, she got so-and-so exclusively. That's amazing. She'd been writing them forever, and they would finally, like, give in. She access every point. Now, the other thing that was amazing about this are the questions, because people are always interested in, you know, how she came up with the questions. On her team, she had a big team, so there's the seniors, there's the people that brought in the coffee. When it's time to do an interview, let's say she's interviewing you, Jim, everybody had to come in with questions, and it better not be, how did you get started? That was not going to fly.
That's my favorite question.
No. So everybody had to come in with some questions, because what she wanted was a range from people with different experiences, from the coffee person to the senior producer.
That's really great.
She had her own questions, and then they would just go over and over and massage and figure it out. And then she'd spend a lot of time, as many have heard by now, ordering the questions. What should go first? What should go second? What's the follow-up? All of that. And I will have to say, she said it, and I will repeat, she knew you better than you knew you by the time she sat down. And one other thing. I work with a lot of correspondents, and some of them use their stardom, if you will, to say, I'm tired of this. I don't want to do it again. Do we have to do it again? Yeah, because you messed up the last time. You want to say, this, if she complained, it would be, oh, my God, can we not get it right? She would do it 59 times until it was right.
I love that.
That driver was sitting outside the office at 2020 many a night when I'd leave at 1 and 2 because she didn't drive. And he'd just have to sit there till she came out because it was going to be right. Oh, yes.
You know, Cal, whenever there's somebody I admire and someone knew them or knows them, I'm nervous to ask this question, but I'll do it anyway. How'd she treat other people?
She was really kind to other people. I can't say who she used to make fun of the most.
Oh, come on.
I cannot, because it's
well,
bad
okay,
faith.
You don't have to tell us who the person
was. Oh, yes,
was.
She does.
Just tell us what she says.
She would just do a dead-on imitation.
She would? Okay.
And it was pretty damn funny.
But did she treat, like,
yes,
normal producers and writers?
She did not tolerate nonsense and not being on your game. I was in a situation where we're now in the studio. So we keep the studio hot every Friday in case something happens. But we taped earlier, okay? So I'm in there. She starts reading. Dr. Tim's on the thing. And I'm listening to it thinking, that's not right. So I say to my top, the executive producer, hello, that's not right. And there's dead silence in the room because no one wants to say anything. Finally, he does this on the microphone. Barbara? We were interrupting her to begin with. Yes? Kelly's producer, not me, the executive producer. Kelly's producer says, that's not right. So she turns and looks at Dr. Tim like, you're sitting here, you didn't say anything. And he goes, well, yeah, kind of, it's not right.
That's pretty good.
And so she says, well, people get it right. And so then she does it again.
But you know what I was amazed at?
I love all that.
And I hope it was real, is that obviously she all the firsts and she worked really hard and was a really driven person. But she did
take time to mentor all these women, which is pretty impressive,
right? She did a lot of that because she was the pathbreaker, and she knew that. And, you know, she took a lot of you-know-what when she came over.
Yes.
And, it was, and then none of it we couldn't even see. So
well, she talked about Harry, Harry Reese being nasty, but the crew being belittled and insulted by people in the crew.
So she just really had to just suck it up, and she decided, I'm not going away. I'm going to figure it out. And that's all that's happening.
And I like The View. I mean, people made fun of The View. Yeah. I love The View. I mean, there are different iterations of The View, and people I like more than other people. But for the most part, it was
a
very
good idea. It's a great idea, and I think, you know, how she handled it, and good for her for reinventing herself at all times.
But, so, Kelly, those are great stories, by the way. Before you tell us what you're doing this weekend, I just want to say, for those who are wondering if Kevin McCarthy's been humiliated for a 12th straight time, they are doing nominating speeches of Hakeem Jeffries. Matt Gaetz is about to get up to nominate somebody other than McCarthy, and then once McCarthy is nominated, if he has been already, hasn't been already, there will be the 12th vote to pick a Speaker of the House. What are you doing this weekend?
We're doing a full hour with the Mass Politics Prof.
Oh, great.
To talk about this just chaotic situation and how it sits in political science, the science of looking at how these things work. As one of my guests said, it's a first in terms of process being at the heart of something so much as opposed to, you know, issues and some other things. So we're also looking at, you know, I asked the question, and I said it's a provocative question, but there are many, many leadership studies that say women lead differently than men, and we're about to have a whole female team here. Is that going to happen here?
Do you remember at the beginning of COVID, there was a story about how countries led by women were doing with COVID as opposed to countries led by men? And I think people know the end of the story.
Yeah, right.
They were dramatically different results, far better in countries led by women.
So. And I should also note that people may not know this, that there is another all-women team, too, in Arkansas.
I know, with Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
And her lieutenant governor.
Yeah. So. Kelly, it's great to see you. We'll be listening and watching this weekend. Kelly Crossley.
Thank you very much, Kelly Crossley. Kelly Crossley is the host of Under the Radar, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. She's also the host of Basic Black, which airs Fridays, that's tonight, at 7:30. You can also hear her Kelly commentaries on Mondays for GBH's Morning Edition. Thanks a lot, Kelly. Coming up, former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral joins us with the latest on the University of Idaho murders and also a standoff, I guess we could call it that, between Mayor Wu and the Boston Police Union. That's next, 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Margaret. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie, and we're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. Andrew Cabral is going to join us in about a minute, and she does. I'll introduce her. Everybody knows we do live music Friday, every Friday, which is one of the things I look forward to all week long. We heard rehearsing some of the players for this Boston Celtic Music Festival done in concert with Club Passim that is happening next week. They are fabulous, and if you want a little bit of an uplift on a dreary day and you're not at the library already, I would venture down. They'll be with us sometime in the 1 o'clock hour. You know what I hope you asked, Andrea? It's on our list of stories we want her input on. Because there's been so much focus, appropriately, on Maura Healey and her historic ascension to the governorship, a candidate that she supported for mayor early on in big time, is now the Attorney General, making history herself. And we haven't talked much about her.
No,
and as an
haven't.
Early supporter, we should get Andrea Cabral's thoughts on Andrea Campbell's ascension. Oh, she is?
Yes. Yeah, so
no, she's not, actually.
She's not here yet.
No, that's why I said she's not with
us
yet.
Oh, I thought you said she was here.
No. See,
I'm
if she
sorry.
Was here, let me explain how this works.
Okay.
If she had been here, I would have said
okay,
she was here. And if she wasn't, okay, fine.
I got it. But you know something? I think we should take some credit for...
For what?
For Andrea Cabral's... Andrea Campbell's success.
Why is that?
Because... Remember when the first time we had her in here when she was
president of the city council?
And she knocked our socks off. I mean, she was so... She talked about urgency, urgency, urgency all the time, whether it was the schools, whether it was the city budget, whatever was going on. She's got an incredible story of overcoming some very serious difficulties in her young life. She just was such an impressive person and a young mother with a couple of kids. So I thought, when I first saw her, I thought, this woman is going places. And she went places really fast, even though obviously she didn't prevail as the mayor. I mean, she went places really fast. And now she's the attorney general, second woman, first African American
in any statewide office. Now to join us to talk about that and a bunch of other things on Zoom is Andrea Cabral. She's a former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety for the Commonwealth, and a weekly contributor to Boston Public Radio. Hello there, Andrea.
Hello. Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. How are you?
We're excellent.
Fine,
thank
Grace.
You.
You know, we were just saying, Andrea, I don't know if you heard it, that when we first had Andrea Campbell on, when she was the head of the city council, she kind of knocked her socks off as just being such a talented politician. And now she's the first African-American woman to be the attorney general of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So you saw something, obviously, in her, too. Tell us what it was that caused you to give her your support for mayor.
Well, she's probably, you know, she's clearly one of the most intelligent people I think I've ever met.
Yep.
But she's also a good critical thinker, and she's able to balance empathy and the compassion that government should have, or that leaders in government should have when they're governing, against a sort of practicalness, right? So she absolutely understands the need for forward progress all the time, and she's always working toward that. But she also isn't sort of this pie in the sky kind of person who's consistently going to set these completely unrealistic goals because they're what people want to hear. She's going to get there, but she's going to get there in a way that's sustainable and that makes sense. And I think that's what people see when they listen to her. They see her authenticity. They see that she's thought these things out and that she has both the capacity and the energy and the political will to get them done. And I think, you know, I just think she's one of those people that sort of just jumps off of her when you meet her and you speak with her. And I think that's what convinces people. It's certainly what convinced me.
You know, by the way, I think we've announced this on the air, but if we haven't, let me announce it again, well, again or the first time. She will be joining us monthly for Ask the Attorney General, starting, we hope, in January, and we're really looking forward to that. Speaking of her ascension, one of the first things she will have to attempt to shepherd through is an appeal that was filed by her predecessor, then Attorney General Maura Healey, of the dismissal of the charges, criminal charges, brought by the Attorney General's office against the guy who was the superintendent and another guy who was the medical director of the Holyoke Soldiers Home, where I think everybody listening or here at the library knows dozens of men who served their country died during the COVID thing. Huge numbers of people. She believed they violated criminal law in their behavior. There's a case now before the state's highest court, the SJC, to reinstate the charges without giving losing us in the weeds. Is your assessment that the state has a shot of reinstating these charges, or did Healey overreach?
Well, you know, when I read the story, I kind of thought this has got a lot of nuances that are going to, you know, be easily escaped in the reporting of it. Even as good as the reporting in Commonwealth Magazine is,
good.
That's where I read the story. It is. It's always very in depth. But part of the issue is that the standard of sort of wanton and reckless in terms of the superintendent Bennett Walsh's behavior in commingling two units, one with people who had been exposed to COVID, others were veterans who had not been exposed to COVID, making that leadership decision based on the practical reality of the problems he was having with staffing, and what we knew about COVID at the time. All of that is what makes it sort of a nuanced decision, both on the part of the Attorney General and on the part of the judge that dismiss the charges. I mean, people should understand that in the AG's office on a case that's this big and this involved, there are lots of people weighing in on this case. There's a lot of critical thinking going into whether or not to bring these charges. So you can rest assured that the potential challenges and even the potential for a dismissal have probably been thought through.
Sure.
I can't imagine that the AG's office would take it a step further if they didn't genuinely believe in the facts of the case, genuinely believe that the Superior Court judge erred. Now, I mean, the bottom line is that it is the kind of case that can be seen two very different ways. This is, you know, it's not necessarily a slam dunk. You know, when you're the prosecutor, you shouldn't always go forward with cases that you believe are slam dunk. Sometimes you should always do what you feel is in the interest of justice, even if ultimately a judge or a higher court disagrees.
You're singing Marjorie's tune, by the way, on a whole variety of things, including cardinal law a long time ago with Tom Riley as AG.
Should have indicted him, even though he was probably going to lose the case. I thought she should have indicted him. You know, let's talk, Andrea, about this case out in Idaho, the four young college students there, ages 20 and 21, that were stabbed to death, slaughtered, we think, in their sleep, allegedly by this Brian Koberger, accused of killing them. You know, we're learning more and more about this case. They found his DNA in the trash back by his parents' house in Pennsylvania that has linked him to the case. But they've also found, remember, there were the four students who were killed, and there were two other roommates there. Mm-hmm. And one of the surviving roommates, to me this is so chilling, told investigators that she heard crying in the house the morning of the murders, and the student heard a voice say, "It's okay, I'm going to help you," and then saw a figure, presumably the killer, a figure clad in black clothing and a mask that covered the person's mouth and nose, walking toward her. She said how she stood there frozen in shock, and then he did not actually come toward her. He walked by her out the sliding glass door. I mean, you covered a lot of murders and prosecuted a lot of murders in your days as a prosecutor. This is such an odd case in so many different ways, Andrea.
I would say it is and it isn't. I look at his background. I look to see, you know, his level of education, the fact that I believe he's a PhD student.
Yes,
yes. He at one point had applied for an internship, was interested in being a police officer in, I think, Pullman, Washington?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Wherever he lives in Washington. Mm-hmm. It is not unusual to me to find someone of his background and education, who is also a potential serial killer or a mass killer, wants to see if they can get away with it, has a fascination perhaps with law enforcement, but also just generally believes that they're the smartest person in the room and that they can get away with it. I mean, what it is, I absolutely agree with you that it is chilling. I think, you know, you can't say it all just by looking at one photograph or two photographs. But if you look at the photos of him, there's not a lot going on behind his eyes.
Yeah.
And that's just the way he looks. I mean, you know, even the picture of him smiling at his own attorney in the courtroom is very chilling. I think these kinds of crimes happen a lot more often than people would like to think. What I will say is the role that DNA, especially genealogical DNA,
it's amazing,
has begun to play in criminal law enforcement is really quite astounding. So essentially, he was living, I think, at home with his parents, at least at the time of his arrest. But mm-hmm. I think before that, or maybe while he was living there, law enforcement had gotten hold of his family's trash, which, you know, once you put it outside, that is abandoned property, and had made a DNA link between him and a DNA profile that was on the trash.
That's incredible.
Made it clear that the DNA profile in the trash had to be his biological father. It was 99.999999%. Everybody else could be excluded, but his father. In the link to the two DNA profiles. So that was part of how they actually tracked him down. And his DNA profile, they got because he left a knife sheath at the scene of the crime.
Yeah.
And that's the other part of this that's fascinating, is people think these crimes through. They think they've committed the perfect crime. They're the smartest person in the room. You always leave something.
Well, you know, when you said he's not that unusual, it made me think, too, of past serial killers. Certainly Ted Bundy, who was a lawyer, very charismatic guy, I guess, to convince these women to go out with him. But remember the Craigslist killer, Andrea, in Boston?
Does she remember?
Yeah.
She was the sheriff the time who imprisoned him.
And he ultimately killed himself and wrote his fiancée's name in blood, his own blood, when he killed himself in prison. But Philip Marker, he was a physician, or he was about to be a physician, right?
Yeah.
So he was very well-educated, obviously. Yeah.
It's a bit of a myth that we really actually – whenever I say this, you know, people look at me funny, or they, you know, because it's such a downer. But the idea that you really know people that you think
you
know is kind of a myth.
Yeah.
I mean, you know exactly what people want you to know up until the time there is something about them that comes to the light that makes you realize that you didn't know them at all. And that's not comforting at all, but it is a reality.
Well,
the good thing is most people you can take at their word that they are who they say they are, but there's a bunch of people that you can't.
And the classic
case. Well, George
case,
Santos being a classic case,
well,
I would say.
Well, the classic case I was going to say is Carol DeMady Stewart.
Oh,
is
point.
It a birthing class with her husband, Charles Stewart? They're going through the birthing class just days before she's going to give birth at the Brigham. They get out and they get in the car and he shoots her in the back of the head. I mean, the man she'd been sleeping next to for all these years, and the fiance and the Craigslist killer, she apparently had no idea that he had this horrible secret life going on either. So that's a great point.
By the way, the dreaded local angle, if I may, local meaning Boston Public Radio, who was the lawyer representing a relative of the husband who...
She represented, Nancy Gertner
represented the brother.
Matthew Stewart, who turned his brother in when his brother had blamed a guy with a record but who had not committed any murder, a black guy. I forget the guy's name. Do you remember the guy's
Willie
name?
Willie Bennett.
Willie Bennett, that's right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you look at Scott Peterson, you look at Sherry Papini.
Yes.
Oh, of course.
Men and women, and people, you just really don't have a clue. I mean, that's it's unfortunate.
Hey,
but.
So never turn your back on anybody, Andrea.
Hey, you know, I don't know if I've ever had this discussion with you. Speaking of never had a clue, since Marjorie Egan mentioned Philip Markoff.
Yes.
And he was under your protection, I guess, for lack of a better he scribbled something on the wall.
His fiance's name.
Well, not just his fiance's name.
Picnic.
Does the sheriff of Suffolk County at the time know what the meaning of what he scribbled was?
I absolutely do. You have been trying to get me to tell you this literally since this thing happened.
And
I'm never going to tell you.
But you really do, wait, do you really know, or are you just taunting me?
Oh, no, I absolutely do
horrible.
Know. But the idea that I can continue to torture you
Thank
about
you.
This
I appreciate it.
Indefinitely, that's among the reasons that I probably
so it wasn't,
never say anything.
It was not picnic, that's wrong? I thought that's what he scribbled.
No.
Oh, okay.
It was a word that people didn't know. Hey, you know, this is an opportunity now, speaking of taunting me by not telling me, anytime Marjorie has an opportunity to say unkind things about the Boston Police Union, she does it in the hopes that her tires will be intact when she leaves the radio. So there is a whole issue now around a negotiation, particularly based on the promises candidate Wu made when she was mayor. And according to the police union, at least, they're in an impasse. They want binding arbitration, which, once that came down, correct me if I'm wrong, either of you, would have to be approved by the city council, which historically they have done like this, no matter what comes out of an arbitrator. What's your take on the situation and whether both Wu and the city council will take a stand if reforms are not part of this deal?
Well, I think the current city council presents the best chance in decades of some pushback.
Yes.
to this, you know, the sort of impenetrability of this particular contract. And I think Wu is right. I mean, I can recall saying the exact same thing on this show over and over again. It always is about the contract. And, you know, every mayor, just as every governor inherits the contract with the state police, every mayor inherits the contract of the local city or town police. in that jurisdiction. And it's not fair that you inherit something that has been, where reform has been ignored for decade after decade after decade. It makes it much more challenging to try to change it. I think this actually might be the single greatest challenge of her being mayor in Boston. It is the reason that people and governors consistently throw up their hands and just cave on these contracts, because there's so much built into them over such a long period of time that it presents a huge challenge. So if you're going to fight, you have to be willing to really go to the mattresses on it if you want to get the reform. And that's what she's going to have to do. Like I said, I think she'll get more support with this current city council than mayors have in the past. But the reality is that that is the road to reform. And all of the perks and all of the entitlements, you know, that are built into that contract, those are the things that the benefits that nobody wants to give up. And those are the things that the union will fight for. But you have to put your foot down and you have to, you know, decide at some point that it's worth the fight. That's a big consideration, because there are a million other things, political and otherwise, that a Boston mayor has to juggle at any given time. And having either the fire department or the police department sort of really fighting you on something, and it's going to be a very public fight, can create, you know, a lot of collateral damage.
It can create a lot of collateral damage. I remember when the Mayor Menino was in a fight with, was it the cops or the firefighters, when one of them went after his wife? They were going to some event.
Wasn't it a State of the City? I think it was the State of the City,
but I forget, was it involved the cops or the firefighters? But you know something? It's my recollection, and you both can correct me if I'm wrong, that Michelle Wu did not get much support from unions in Boston.
No, they supported
anyway.
Her opponent for the most part. Public employee unions.
Yeah. And that gives her a bit of leverage. I mean, you're right, it would be going through a very difficult process, but it gives her a little bit more leverage. And she's been putting up with people that are former corrections officers and police officers still outside her house for all that time, yelling and horrible things with her mother, who's battled mental illness, and her two children inside the house. So she's shown a toughness so far that I much admire.
You know, one of the issues, if we can, Bill Evans used to be, Commissioner Evans was a regular monthly on our show. And by the way, we've taken some criticism in texting through the weeks that we have not had the new commissioner, Michael Cox, on. We're dying to have the new commissioner, Cox, on. We've invited him repeatedly, and we're confident that at some point, once he gets his legs under him there, he will join us, hopefully regularly. Remember the discussions you would have, particularly with Evans, about cops, dirty cops? How could they possibly still be on the force? And what did he say in every situation, Marjorie?
I thought
you were asking me, and I was going to say I didn't actually have those conversations.
No, we did. And what did he say?
He basically said that there were officers that he fired because of malfeasance and stealing money and doing bad things and being violent and stuff, and they were reinstated with back pay through arbitration. I mean,
so that process. I mean, I happen to support arbitration. That process has to be changed in some fashion so there's more equity and it's not a slam dunk in most cases. For the union, because it does protect and put back on the beat cops who shouldn't be out there allegedly protecting us.
Right. And that's the problem. I mean, the sheriffs face that problem. You know, the Department of Corrections face anytime you've got, you know, a union where your binding arbitration is part of the contract. Mm-hmm. You all face that problem. And in law enforcement jobs of any stripe, the stakes are just that much higher. Yeah. I mean, you see the Post Commission, after having finally gotten its feet under it, and is, you know, actually moving forward, only 15 officers in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts have been suspended. And, you know, I realize it's their first foray out, but it does show you how challenging it is, and it shouldn't be. It's wrong, and it shouldn't be.
Okay, now one last thing, Andrea Cabral. You were the sheriff of Suffolk County. You were a prosecutor in Suffolk County. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you're in your many years serving Suffolk County, you ever encountered a couple who called 911, wanting the cops to come help them move belongings out of a home that they were robbing.
you know,
which happened in Florida, by the way.
It actually happened in Florida.
And of the 50 states, Florida is the state where this would happen. There's genuinely something wrong.
In oh, you Florida, think so?
It has the weirdest. So there are two people inside a house that is not theirs.
Correct.
A man and his girlfriend. The man at the time, he's burglarizing this house that he obviously doesn't belong in, mm-hmm. is also wanted for burglarizing a Dollar Tree store a few days before.
Of course he is.
They apparently are ill-prepared for this burglary as they've not figured out a way to make off with the ill-gotten gains in a way that doesn't involve them calling local law enforcement and asking them to help with the move. I mean, it's Florida. It's just Florida. So they call and they say, you know, can you help us with the move? And can sure. you give us a ride to the airport? Because we're going to spend the weekend in New York. Now, I don't know what they were taking out of this house that required them to get help. But they were also going to take it to the airport yeah. and then take it to sure. New York. Like a chair and a couch and a TV.
I don't know.
I don't even know. I don't, there really are not words for this. And if stupidity was a crime, oh my God.
Guilty.
You know, Andrea, you mentioned that weird things happen in Florida. Alex Beam, the great columnist of the Boston Globe, had a whole column talking about Florida man. And he, you know, goes toe-to-toe with an alligator or something. It's called Florida man. Like all the stories, Florida man. In this case, yep. Florida man and woman. There is something, maybe it's just Ron DeSantis has worn them all down there. I don't know. But anyway, there is something in the water in Florida.
It's the heat. It's the humidity.
It's the heat. Okay.
Hey, Andrea, it's great to talk to you as always. Be well.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Andrea Cabral. We've been speaking with Andrea Cabral. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and she joins us every week. Okay, for a moment in time, Elon Musk was the richest man in the world. His latest claim to fame, losing more money than anyone else in human history. No thanks, of course, to Jim with his shiny new Model 3.
Excuse me.
But that's another story we'll
Thank
get to later.
Thank you for bringing that up.
So how much did Elon Musk lose? Our media maven, Sue O'Connell, is here to talk about that. Maura Healey's historic inauguration and more. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting today from the Boston Public Library, and we are streaming at youtube.com/GBH News.
Trusted. Local. News. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR. What matters to you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie, live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBHNews. We're about 20 minutes away from some fabulous Celtic music. And I think we're about 10 minutes away from another humiliation for Kevin McCarthy. However, Manu Raju from CNN, their Capitol Hill reporter, is reporting that of the 20 people who were not voting for Kevin McCarthy, 5 representatives have broken away from, I'll call them the rebels, I can't think of a better term. The 5 of them are now voting for McCarthy. So at least as far as we know, there are 15 fellow Republicans. He can only lose 4. Who are opposing his candidacy as Speaker. We'll bring you an update as soon as the votes are final. But here at first, take on the social norms and abnormalities of the day is media maven Sue O'Connell. Sue is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News and contributor to Current on NBC, LX, and NECN. Hello, Sue O'Connell.
Good day. Happy New Year.
And hello,
Good
hello.
Hello, Sue O'Connell.
Thank you.
Quoting for herself, as she
yes,
always does
that's
here.
What I do. Someone's going to do it.
I read the Globe today, big picture of Governor Healey and Lieutenant Governor Driscoll on the front page, and the story starts with a quote from Arlene Isaacson. Mm-hmm. We all remember Arlene Isaacson, who was crusading for gay rights back when you could get thrown out of your apartment or lose mm-hmm. your job or have terrible
things, not against the law, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, saying she never thought she'd see a day when a gay woman became the lesbian became the governor of Massachusetts. It's our media maven and resident lesbian here, Sue O'Connell. I mean, what do you think? Was a little flutter in your heart?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to do the inaugural coverage yesterday on NBC 10 with J.C. Monahan and Corey Smith. And, you know, at the end, Corey said, you know, what are your closing thoughts? And basically, it's I'm not that much older than Maura Healey, but I don't think either one of us thought that we would see a lesbian governor at any time soon. I mean, obviously, there are other gay governors in the country ahead of us, or, you know, some 40 female governors ahead of us over time. But at the same time, in the world that Arlene and Governor Healey and myself were born into, our existence was basically illegal. And we could, and still, important to note, in many states, you could still be fired simply for being gay. And there's still a war against LGBTQ people in this country. So I'm also, I've had a number of sort of dinner conversations about how little Maura Healey's sexual orientation was mentioned during the campaign, and how if it had been 15 years ago, we would have been mad at her because she wasn't talking enough about it, that it seemed like it would. But because she has been a well-established, and we are where we are now in Massachusetts, it was almost completely unimportant to her campaign.
Yeah,
and
almost never mentioned.
And rightly so, unless it naturally happened, especially around her fight for against the Defense of Marriage Act here in Massachusetts and the work that she did as Attorney General. So
she may not have mentioned it, but having said, you know, we have all the candidates call into the radio show on the election day. We asked her about that, and you can hear the emotion in her voice in every speech she has made since, from the inaugural address yesterday to the victory address on whatever November date was. It's clear how much this means to her and how she understands how much it means to a lot of little kids who are growing up. By the way, here's a piece of Healey's speech yesterday. She's talking about the historic rights that have been established for people of Massachusetts.
Our state constitution recognized our natural and essential rights and declared them to the world. The people of Massachusetts have always believed in protecting these rights and dedicating them to a higher purpose. We were the first to guarantee that health care is universal. And 20 years later, that love is too.
I love that line.
Yep.
By the way, I mentioned to you on the air, you had 20 dopes on with you the night of the election.
Like, like Congressman Capuano.
Other than Congressman Capuano. And, well, there were about 18 dopes who thought her speech on election night was horrible.
This one was much better.
This was really a wonderful speech.
I have to say, though, there's always, you know, like Governor Baker and like other elected officials, you know, there's campaigning, there's governing, right? And then there is who you are. You are who you are.
Yeah.
And I think that this speech for Governor Healey was much better than her election night speech.
I agree with that.
And I think it, you know, really was authentically her. The story she told about how her grandmother brought dirt from Massachusetts and put it under
Maryland
where she was born. And
how
said,
did you do that?
But I said, I would have been telling that story on the campaign trail every single time I went out.
Right.
Like, it's not anything that she ever did.
But where were the nurses and the doctors and the sanitation?
Oh, it was the 1960s,
Marjorie. Dirt underneath the delivery
table. It was
the
60s. They didn't even wash their hands.
Okay, so can we discuss my obsession? And Marjorie says that's what we do in the show. We discuss my obsession.
Jim's obsession.
We're watching this damn inaugural address yesterday. And I turned to, I think Adam was in the studio with me, and I was talking to Zoe, I was talking to Jamie, I was talking to Marjorie at home. There's some 6'1" white guy,
the clerk,
standing on the stage about 3 feet to the right of Healey at the exact same level with the exact same level podium, standing there through the whole thing. At which point, halfway through, and I'm saying, what is this security? What is this? At that point, Adam says, we're looking at the screen. He says, the guy's texting. Not only is he standing there through
they
the whole
care.
Speech,
yeah.
he is. Well, we did a little research. It turns out, as we said yesterday, Michael Hurley, the Senate clerk.
Yep, the clerk.
Jamie, our colleague, called the clerk's office today. He was put on hold. After he's put on hold, an assistant to the clerk says, I wouldn't read too much into this. Just needed a place to stand. Well, we put up these pictures here. Zoe, our colleague, went back 4 years and found the exact same Senate clerk
who was at the exact same inaugural address by a different person. That'd be Charlie Baker. And what a shock. There he is.
There he is.
He's not standing at that podium next to Baker.
So he's
stealing the limelight. He is standing on the damn floor where he should be.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a moment.
I wish you wouldn't, but go ahead.
By the way, who's next to Hurley? Is that the lieutenant governor there? Who's that?
Yes.
Wait, in that shot?
Yeah, so it's...
Yeah, Polito, yeah.
Polito. So,
yeah.
Okay. You know who else we couldn't see all during the speech?
Yes, Kim Driscoll.
Kim Driscoll.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure who set up...
Maybe the camera angle.
It's your fault, Sue. It's my fault.
If you're going to defend this...
No, I'm just going to say as a family member of clerks of court from all across the place, like the Cambridge clerk of court.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
They think that this is their room, right? And like the clerks in D.C. who are trying to keep the congresspeople... in order. This is their business.
How many clerks in D.C. stood on the podium with Nancy Pelosi when she was speaking?
But she's standing at she's the one doing the roll call and telling everybody.
Because there's nobody else there. She's leading the forum.
So the other point
that's
I want to make.
That's a great job, by the way, the clerk of courts. Great pension. Great
pension.
Okay,
great
fine. Because she has family members on the payroll, too. Who retired at like 45 years old.
And then got another job at the NBTA.
That's
right.
Okay, so what's your defense?
My other point is that you saw William Galvin, Senator Galvin, Bill Galvin, Secretary of State Galvin, also very involved, telling them where to sign and what to do.
If she had a sign, he had to walk up to her. Her speech was over.
But he was also whispering to her, you have to sign here and you have to
sign. Are you related to this guy?
No, I'm
what
not.
Is going
I just
on?
Think, I just think that this was the first time, and I think that they just needed a little extra help, and I think the guy was just making sure
that there's an audience here. How many people thought it was appropriate yesterday that whoever the hell the Senate clerk is standing on the podium at the same level as Morley Healy? Who thought it was a... Can
it
I talk to the audience,
level.
Please?
He looked like he was
no, but he's standing... I know,
because
he's taller.
Because she's 5 foot four.
Who
she's
thought that four. Was appropriate? Raise your hands. Nobody. Because nobody's related to Michael Hurley like you apparently are. By the way, this is... And I repeat, and then I'm going to drop it for today. I'm going to get back to it tomorrow.
We'll see.
It's interesting...
Tomorrow.
It was apparently fine, according to Sue O'Connell, when it's Maura Healey, but when Charlie Baker was doing it, who happens to be 6'6", the guy decided to stand on the floor. What do you say to that?
Well, I just think everyone knew how to sign the papers with Charlie Baker.
Oh,
that's
this
all.
Is
that's
really
all I'm saying. That's
weak,
what the clerk does.
Friend.
The texting, I would have had a problem with.
Well, as his office said to Jamie, I wouldn't read too much into this. I would. Just needed a place to stand. We're going to put those photos up at some point, and you can judge for yourself. We're talking to Sue O'Connell, who's an apologist for the clerks.
For the clerks of Cork, all across the country.
Exactly.
Speaking of somebody else Jim can't stop complaining about is Prince Harry.
Oh please.
Wow. Okay, here he is. He's in an interview with something called ITV. It's set to come out Sunday, talking about the rift. You know.
Shut up.
Well, before,
not you.
Before it shut up.
Harry.
I mean... Bill Clinton had a problematic brother, right? That was, I think, doing a little cocaine or whatever he was doing. Jimmy Carter had a tough brother.
Billy Beard. Don't you remember Billy Beard?
Beard. Yeah. You know, I mean, at least George Bush has some nice brothers. Just Trump
well,
has...
Well, George Bush was the bad brother. So
George Bush was the bad brother. Yeah. George Sr. couldn't get over it.
No.
How did this happen? Jeb was supposed to be the good one. But Donald Trump, he had no energy. That's what he called him, low energy Jeb. And that was the end of that. But in any case, Prince Harry has a brother who's going to be the King of England. They apparently don't get along.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, really. Okay, so here is Prince Harry talking about the rift in his family in the revelations from Harry's new book.
What was different here was this level of frustration. And you know, I talk about the red mist that I had for so many years.
Good music.
And I saw this red mist in him. He wanted me to hit him back, but I chose not to.
There's a fair amount of drugs, marijuana, magic mushrooms, cocaine. I mean, that's going to surprise people.
But important to acknowledge. I want reconciliation. But first, there needs to be some accountability. The truth, supposedly, at the moment, has been there's only one side to this story.
Ugh.
Okay, shut up. I don't want to hear anymore. No, I want to say something. By the way, if he wants to...
turn in your brother for snorting cocaine with him? I don't think so.
No, he's not. He's just saying he did it. Harry's saying Harry's admitting
that
he
did it. Can I make something clear here? If he wants to speak to the racism directed at his wife, which was grotesque, I'm fine with that. I'm not only fine with it, I encourage it. This is the most selfish... self-possessed,
I have to agree
sick
with Jim.
Crap that I've ever heard.
I have to agree with Jim.
Really?
Yeah, because I've been, you know, we'll have our royal podcast at some point, Marjorie and I. And although I don't love Meghan, I so totally see where she's coming from and totally believe the racism was real. I believe all the things that she has said.
And she had a tough life.
Totally, totally support in her point of view and her ability to talk about it. And I expected I'd see more from that from Harry. But this is the excerpts that we've seen are the most petty family BS that I've ever seen in my entire life. I am so sorry that you were born into a family, right, that you are not going to be the, you know, the, it's basically the royal family's Disneyland for the Brits, right? So I'm sorry you don't get to be Mickey Mouse, that your brother's going to grow up to be Mickey Mouse. You just get to live in a cottage that they give you enough money to read. I'm so sorry that you, this therapy session that you think you need to give us in this book, from what it seems, it's just, it's petty. It's just petty and stupid.
But you know what, often when we talk about Donald Trump, which is far too often, even though less lately, actually, some, I say the thing that concerns me is less Trump and the fact that 70 million people knew who he was, and 73 million, I think, decided to vote for him. This book is going to be the number one best-selling book, probably in every single country in which it's published in the world.
Well, because
what does that say about?
No, it's the fascination of the royal family. I mean, you know, the one thing I have really learned from this Harry and Meghan expose is just that it's really a tourist attraction. You know, and these people that are living in it, the royal family that are in it, really think, although they say publicly, well, we don't think God picked us to do this anymore. They really do. And it's a business that they do to attract attention and tourism to Great Britain. And that's what, and that's all it is. And he's, you know, Harry's a troubled young man who's finally found a wonderful wife who hopefully will take care of him and we'll never have to hear from him again.
So, media maven Sue O'Connell, this new law down in Louisiana, that when you try to go on the very popular websites, Pornhub.
I don't think you have to read all the websites, Marjorie. You really don't.
Or RedTube.
Thank you.
That you will need not just to say that you are over 18 or over 21, you are going to have to present proof of age like a government issued ID.
A lot of men are doing
such
that.
Such as a driver's license to access these sites. What do you think it's going to do to the pornography business in Louisiana?
Well, I'm not sure it's going to pass, but it does raise...
Oh, it's only a bill?
Yeah.
Oh, it's not a law.
I think it's only a bill, right?
I thought it was a law, too.
Is it a law?
Well, whatever it is. I'll look it up. Go ahead. You keep
talking.
Anyway,
but the challenge... Well, I don't know if it's going to pass other parts
think,
of it, if
it's
a law.
I think it's happened.
The challenge here is
it
that
is a law. Go ahead.
It's the accessibility of porn on the internet is overwhelming. I mean, you basically just have to make a keystroke mistake, and you end up with some of the most horrific legal. I'm just talking about the legal stuff that you wouldn't want to see. And also, you know, on Twitter, I'm always shocked that occasionally somebody is posting really graphic porn on a somebody I
there's
I
more
follow,
now under Elon
right,
Musk
than
by
there
the
was
way,
before.
Was before.
And so you just imagine all of the children and people under 18 and that are being exposed to this. I know you've talked to therapists and doctors who talk about how this has changed, and an author who talked about how this has changed, how people expect young people expect sex to be, how it's really damaging their development, damaging their maturity, and all of that. So having said that, if you've ever actually wanted to access a legal porn site, a commercial or free legal porn site, it simply asks you, are you 18?
Yeah, everybody says yes.
And you say, yes, I am, and you go in. So the challenge here is how do you moderate people being under 18 accessing porn sites, which you don't want them to, which they're covered by the section 231 in Washington.
Oh, the Communications Decency Act, or whatever
or
it is. Is that right, Decency Act?
So, you know, do you ask them for a government ID, which then they're taking your information, and although you have to present an ID to buy a lot of things, cigarettes, get into clubs, they're not taking your information. I don't know what the answer to this is. I don't think it's a bad idea to make it harder for people under 18?
Oh, yes. I know what the answer is.
What's the answer?
Phony IDs in Louisiana. It's going to be like the biggest market. By the way, what's her name? Gail Dines believes, does she believe, I know she believes, does she believe pornography is not free speech? She does, right? We talked to her multiple times about this.
I'm not sure. Should not be protected. I don't know what she believes about free speech, but I do know that she believes that this is doing tremendous harm.
It is.
Oh, it is. No question.
Because they think that they're supposed to look like porn stars. They're supposed to have this
sex like porn stars.
Any kind of encounter that happens with anything on porn sites.
You know, 15-year-old boys expect things from 15-year-old girls that are most of us are not, you know, very happy about. So, yeah, it's really done a lot of damage. I mean, you've even heard where people
that young men, which I find hard to believe, but young men are not interested in regular sex because they're so wrapped up with pornography.
Well, you think about the screens. I mean, you think about how all the information that young people are getting mostly is from screens, and that's how their brains are getting imprinted. Not a psychologist or a brain expert here. So, this law, again, has its challenges because the last thing you want the government doing is collecting your information when you are looking at something that is covered by free speech. But at the same time, it is ridiculously easy to get by the RU18.
You know, speaking of free speech, which makes
me
think of courts.
Maybe people in Louisiana won't look at so much porn.
The red states look at the most porn.
Oh, are you joking, by the
red
way?
States
you don't
look
think
at the
they're going to find a way around this?
I guess
I mean,
so,
really.
But if you have to put a government ID, you have to do, as you say, the fake IDs. Yeah.
Red states look at the most porn.
Do they do?
Yep.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Do you know that or are you just saying
no,
that?
No, absolutely. Per capita, Republican states and states that say they're more religious look at the most porn.
Actually, I saw a survey like this. We mentioned this 2 days ago. It's red states and the people who work at Boston City Hall.
Yes.
Those are the two. That, by the way, that used to be the case. We know this from a prominent former Boston City Hall official who we all know who told us that until they turned off the porn machines, nobody could do
any
work.
No one could get a clerk to come out and deal with their parking tickets because they're in the back looking
at the porn.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay, you know, we're going to play a little. Apparently, our colleagues, meaning our producers, et cetera, are looking at you and seeing, you know, this set, I hope we don't offend any of our colleagues, is maybe the worst set in the history of radio.
Oh, yes.
And Marty and I are standing
is that
up.
Our set?
Yes, Marty and I are standing up, and you're sitting down, and you look like you're a tiny little person. And,
Do
you know who Chris,
does
you know Chris Fleming is?
Chris
Fleming is a comedian from a local comedian who's huge, who's just brilliant. He was here with us the other day. The next night, he was at the Wilbur. And he commented on his appearance on this particular
show.
He opened his whole bit with this. Jared was here. You were
did
not
you
here.
Did you tell me this?
I don't know
no,
if I did.
No, let's take a listen.
In any case, here's just a little clip of what he had to say about his experience, essentially just like you
like
as
this.
Sue O'Connell.
Yes.
Here's Chris Fleming.
And the mayor is standing on their level, on the two interviewers' level. Then she leaves, and they change the whole set. And they put me in what can only be described as like a sci-fi dystopian courtroom. My hands have never been plunged so deep into my pocket. Look at how bad a time I'm having. They are looming over me.
Same deal. By the way, he puts up an image of him like this, sitting. Look at it is unbelievable. Look at you.
Yeah, it is. It is. I usually stand, but I'm tired today.
This is well. Yep. Maybe keep the camera just on. Well, it's too late for that. Okay, before you go, talk about hypocrisy. Marjorie, unfortunately, wants to talk about EVs at the end of the show, and it's
that's
only
right.
the only. Let me tell you, I know the only reason she wants to talk about EVs is not to praise me because I have one, but because I criticize Elon Musk and I just bought a Tesla.
Well, you
a
had
few
to wait on.
Ago.
You had to wait on the list.
Yeah, I know, but that's no excuse. Guilty as charged. In any case,
one snazzy car.
Not only does he endorse DeSantis white because you don't have to pay extra for white. Don't ask me any questions about it, okay?
You wouldn't let me in the car until I wrap myself in Saran.
Well, that makes sense.
And you
sense.
Did, because
that
I wanted to keep
sense.
It clean and neat yesterday. She had her first ride in the car.
That.
It was very.
Yes,
then
that.
I asked her to leave without touching the door, which she did, which I'm still upset about.
Gloves on.
Can I just get to my point here for a second?
Yeah.
What was my point? Oh,
Elon.
Not only is he endorsed DeSantis, and by the way, I don't want him to endorse Joe Biden. No. I don't want him to endorse anybody. He's now endorsed Kevin McCarthy for the speakership. What's wrong with people like me, I guess, is the question that I'm... Are you still there?
Yeah.
And what's wrong with you then? What's wrong with you and me? Marjorie is less active, so let's leave her out of this. What's the problem? Why are we not rebelling
against this? So why are we still on
Twitter?
So I have cut way back on my Twitter usage. I'm
because
not,
of this?
Yeah, I have.
Well,
I cut back on tweeting. So I'm not tweeting as much. I still am kind of putting business stuff out, segments that I do
that's
and where I'm going to be. But I'm not engaging in Twitter in a
and you do, and you
way.
Engage with almost anybody who writes
you. Yeah, I go, if somebody says something terrible to me and they have four followers, I'll spend the whole afternoon arguing with them.
Sick.
And, but I have pulled way back because I just think Elon is acting in a way that is more difficult for me to stand than other CEOs who do other terrible, horrible things. As I've said, I have an iPhone. I'm not sure who built it, but I still have one. I'm on Facebook. They basically, almost ruined our entire democracy, but I'm still on Facebook. But Elon's inserting himself into this mix in Twitter that is making it really volatile. Because he's a personality, I think, is what is disturbing me. So I'm not using it as much. I've gone to Post News which I'm on.
A lot of people have.
It's just not as much fun as Twitter, which is a
challenge.
Nor
is Mastodon, and it's a little harder to use, at least for me so
far. Mastodon, I can't quite figure out how to get on yet. You know, and I'm just waiting to see what happens with Twitter. I'm reading a lot about how, you know, we keep thinking that these things are going to last forever, and it may not. But I'm not thrilled with the ads that I get served. I'm not thrilled with how he's serving the ads. I really don't need to look at the ping pong ball over and over again. I'm not going to buy the ping pong ball, so stop showing
That's
it to me. So I'm still there. I mean, I'm fascinated by Elon Musk. As I think I said before in the show, Ruby reminded me, my daughter who's 22 now, that about 10 years ago I said to her, "Hey, this Elon Musk guy, you should probably go work for him." You know, and so another way that I am wrong. But yeah, I'm still there though.
Okay, it's nice to see you,
Sue
O'Connell.
To see you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
very
much,
Sue
O'Connell.
We've been speaking with our media maven Sue O'Connell, who
media
is also
Sue
the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News and a contributor to Current on NBC, LX, and NECN. She is one busy gal. Anyway, after a quick break, we're going to talk. Oh, we're going to have our live Music Friday, the first one of the year. We're celebrating 20 years of the Boston Celtic Music Festival, which kicks off next week at Cambridge's Club Passim. Co-organizers Sean Smith and Sumner McCall join us next. We're going to hear music not just from one band, but from two. Live Music Friday is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library and streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marge Regan. We're live at the Boston Public Library. Stream at youtube.com/GBHnews. The vote on the 12th ballot for Speaker is not over, but I have to say, it appears this may change in the next few minutes. There are only 7 people voting for somebody else, down from 20 last night on the 11th ballot. We'll try to bring you the latest as soon as we see it. But first, thank God, the time is upon us. Live Music Friday here at the library. This week, the first of 2023. We feel the same way. We're celebrating 20 years of the Boston Celtic Music Festival. It's their first year in person since COVID hit. There's a ton of shows going on. And not just that, workshops, sessions for people to gather, play music together, all in the deeply rooted tradition of Celtic music, which, Marjorie, I have to admit, you know, I wasn't crazy about till Brian O'Donovan introduced us years ago, and it changed my life. We're joined now by Sean Smith and Sumner McCall, co-organizers of the Boston Celtic Music Festival, heading into its first year in person since the pandemic. And by the way, for more information on shows starting Thursday next week, we'll talk a lot about them. How to get tickets, go to Passim. We'll tell you why. PASSIM.org. Welcome to you both. Great to see you.
Thank you, Jim. Well, thank you so much for being here. So, Sean, let's start with you, since you've been there a very, very long time. I think this is the first one.
Not quite. I was a participant in the first one, and then I began volunteering for the festival for the second year, and then I was elevated, if that's the correct word, to the board of directors for the one after that, and ever since then.
So the answer is he's been involved since the beginning. That's the bottom line.
Okay. I have a way of...
So tell people what is going to happen this week, next weekend.
What is going to happen? This is a coming together of Boston's incredibly diverse and rich Celtic music community. Irish, Scottish, Cape Breton, other Celtic-influenced, Celtic-inspired types of music, to literally compare notes, you know, what they're doing, what kinds of things are interesting to them about the music. And this is performers and non-performers. It's just really a celebration of all that we have here in Boston, things Celtic music.
As I said, I've learned a lot and not enough about Celtic music from Brian and listening to Brian and talking to Brian. Heavy metal Celtic, I have never heard about before I was reading the summary. What's the deal, Summer?
Well, to correct, it's not quite heavy metal.
Heavy-ish
Celtic,
metal?
We do have a slight divergent from the traditional Celtic music, you could say, on Friday night at the very end of the Boston Urban Cayley, which is at the Crystal Ballroom in Davis Square, where we're going to end the night after a bunch of traditional dances with Celtic EDM music that's put on by a project called Rambler, with Elias Alexander, who he's going to be, he did all the beats and all the cool kinds of EDM-ish stuff, and then we'll be playing instruments over it with some of his Loud Weather band members.
And by the way, there are different venues, and I should have said Cambridge and Summer, really, you can find them all at the website, which we'll talk about in a minute.
And Summer, you've done it for the last 2 years when it's been a COVID kind of thing.
Right.
So how did you pull this off with COVID?
Well, we were planning a smaller version of it last year where it was just going to be at Passim. We knew that we needed to make some adjustments, but then everything kind of came crashing down again during the holidays, as people might remember with the Omicron.
Yes.
So we put it on our virtual platform, which we had been doing at Passim since the beginning of the lockdown. And it was an easy transition. All of our artists were very supportive and understanding. And we're just so happy to be able to do it in person this year for the 20th anniversary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, could you describe a little bit more, in addition to some very well-known people, and we were listening to The Fiddler, who's going to play a minute ago, I mean, earlier in the day.
Yeah.
She is otherworldly great,
totally.
I should say. She is just, this is more of Sean Scanlon, I assume.
Yeah.
But there are also sessions where real people who are into the music come and just, I love it. Is that, did I get it right, I hope?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. sessions are kind of where all the Celtic music just sort of comes to hang out in an informal way, and people just get together just simply for the enjoyment of it and to try out tunes. And this is people who are beginners, people who are intermediate, and those, you know, who are far and above.
Well, that's one of the things you see in Ireland, right? You go into a bar in Ireland, there's music, and there might be three people, and then suddenly there's three more people.
Yeah.
And they're all playing together.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
And that concept is relatively new, the whole coming together, playing a shared repertoire. It used to just be people would come together and, like, teach each other tunes at pubs, and it became a little bit more of a tourist attraction back in the 60s, 70s, and now it is what we see it today at so many sessions and pubs. I mean, I think the other day with friends, we counted about 15 in just Boston area alone a week.
Oh my gosh.
That you could go to. So the ones at the BCM Fest are going to be at the church across the street, and there's going to be a beginner kind of slow version, and then we have Scottish, Cape Breton, a song session, and an Irish session. So it's going to be very, very fun and a good little window into some of the sessions that happen around here.
By the way, it's the 12th to the 15th. We said next week we should say the exact date. I want to hear the music, if you don't mind. The first group of people playing is Maura Sean Scanlon over there on fiddle. Hi there, Maura. Eamon Sefton. Hi, Eamon. How are you? You look just like Ken Casey. He doesn't think he does, but he does from the drop kicks. Trust me, you do. And Connor Hearn on guitar. And the song you're playing is Squall. Is that correct? Oh, it's your song. Your mic is on, but it's your song? You wrote this thing. By the way, you didn't hear that, but Maura wrote this song. So The Squall, and here they are. Thank you.
That was absolutely fantastic. That was more Sean Scanlon on the fiddle and the writer of the song, Eamon Sefton, tenor guitar, and Connor Hearn on the guitar. And the song is Leaving Harvey Street. That was unbelievable. So okay.
That was Squall. That was Squall?
Oh, that was Squall.
Was that Squall? It was.
Oh,
that
I'm
was
sorry.
Fabulous.
Oh, I'm sorry, sorry, sorry. So
that was great, by the way, all three of you. Thank you so much.
Tell us why, I mean, besides the fact that everybody thinks it was Boston, it's an Irish town, and lots of people came to live here, obviously. Are we unusual in this Irish tradition here, Celtic tradition here?
I think so, and it's not just an Irish music town. There have been generations of people from Cape Breton up in Nova Scotia
yes.
who've come down to what they call the Boston States and settled here, and they brought their music and their dance with them. And so Boston, for generations, has had the Cape Breton enclave. And a very rich Scottish tradition as well, going back decades. They have the Royal Scottish Country Dance Society branch here is decades old. So I think in that respect,
yeah.
Boston is very special, is having such a diversity of
yeah.
these sounds and styles.
I would also say that there are a few other cities in America that have a strong Celtic community, like Chicago has a really good one. There's some good stuff going on in New York. But I think you're right when you say the history of immigrants coming here and coming down from both Ireland, Cape Breton, Scotland, they really brought a lot, and it is bursting with musicians, especially right now. It seems like the pandemic break was good for the scene. A lot
yeah.
of people have come flooding in.
Yeah, you could do a lot of practicing yeah. by yourself yeah. in your house, too.
Well, only so much.
We're talking about the Boston Celtic Music Fest, 12th to the 15th of January. We're joined by Summer McCall, lead organizer, Sean Smith, co-organizer. Summer, back to you. For those few people who don't know about the history of
yeah.
Club Passim, I mean, explain its involvement here, but also explain a little bit about its history, not just Passim, Club 47, the whole deal.
Yeah, well, Passim has been... It's a nonprofit that has been a nonprofit for about 27 or so years. But before that, it was a venue still in Harvard Square dating back to the late 50s. And we've had some amazing musicians come through, kind of get their feet in the door. Like we always like to boast about the Baez, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan's.
Tom Rush, a good friend of ours.
Yeah,
yes.
So many good people have come through Passim. Tracy Chapman, we've had Lake Street Dive, the Anais Mitchell for Hadestown. We're a fantastic little venue that has such a rich history and future with not just Celtic music, but folk music as a genre that is very open.
And blues music. I mean,
yeah.
Tom has told us about the blues musicians.
Yeah.
When he was at Harvard as a kid,
totally.
He would say when he would saunter over there and listen yeah. to these legendary blues players.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. We were one of the venues, as far as I believe, that really started bringing jazz and blues to the New England area. One of them. But yeah, there's such a strong history. If people haven't been to Passim or checked it out yet, we have shows every night of the year of varying genres.
By the way, you're too smiling a lot. I don't know if you're aware of this. Through this whole discussion,
I think it's
a very good
if
thing.
If that last set doesn't get your heart pumping, then you got to listen a little
Well, we're going to hear another set. And say, is there anything we're missing that we should be telling people about Summer? You're about to speak. Is there something?
I'm trying to think. Well, yeah, just checking out the full list because there's something every night. So.
Well, you guys are great, and we're going to hear from two of your colleagues yet again. This time, and thank you for joining us, and we'll give all the ticket information and the schedule information in a couple of minutes. We have a different group. Well, not a totally different group. Hi, how are you guys? This time we have Adam Hendy. Where are you, Adam? Hi, Adam. Nice to see you. With Simon Lace. What's that thing you're playing here? Mandola. Oh, my God. And Eamon is back yet another time, and I believe you're playing Castle by the Sea. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Here it is, Castle by the Sea.
Rise up, my lady. Blushing by the bay, we'll go to my castle by the sea. So bring along your marriage fee, which you can claim today. Bring along your milk white steed, the milk white and gray. And she rode out on a milk white steed, he rode the turban gray. He took the path by the ocean. I've heard them say, when they came to the castle, it looked so dark and cold. And she was, she'd stayed in Boston with all her family's gold. Six maids I've drowned here, and the seventh one you'll be. So take off your fancy cloak, come lay it down by me. It's what you find to leave behind, throw into the sea. She said, I won't lay down this fine silk gown my mother gave to me, unless you look down at the ocean. Back to the willow tree. He looked down at the ocean with his back to the willow tree. The lady took him in her arms. She flung him in the sea. Die instead of me. The six maids you drown here, pull you to the sea. And she mounted up the milk white steed and let the turban gray. They rode back to Boston at the dawning of the day.
Simon Lace and Eamon Shifton, and the song, get it right this time, Marjorie, Castle by the Sea. That was absolutely
great,
gorgeous. Boy, what a very nice guy, was he? Castle by
Thank you, you
hey,
too.
Thank you so much
it's
for
great.
Being here.
Thank We've
been
you.
Speaking with Sean Smith and Summer McCall from Club Passim's Boston Celtic Music Festival. It kicks off next Thursday, the 12th. For more details, go to passim.org. And you click on their live music tab. Summer McCall is a lead organizer. Sean is a longtime participant and co-organizer. And I'm going to give the website again to get all the info on this event, which is starting next Thursday and runs all during the weekend, is passim.org. And you click on their live music tab. Thank you
Thank
so
you
much.
Both.
Thank you
great.
For having
Thanks
us.
Thanks to the players.
Coming up, we're opening up the phone and text lines. The state is investing more than $400 million in electric vehicle charging infrastructure. Just in time for Jim Browdy
Don't do this.
And his fancy new Musk-mobile.
Thank you, Marjorie. I appreciate it. 877-301-8970
is the number to call or text to ask, is that what it's going to take to get you out of your gas car and into an EV, all these electric vehicle charging stations? 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library and streaming on youtube.com/GBHnews.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan broadcasting live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews. We'll be back at the library as we are every Tuesday. Next Tuesday, Friday, we will not be here. We'll be broadcasting live from the dedication of the Embrace Memorial, the beautiful Embrace Memorial dedicated to Martin Luther King Jr., his wife Coretta Scott King, and 60-plus civil rights leaders who changed history here in Boston.
Who is the comedian that ridiculed us?
Chris Fleming.
Chris Fleming. Okay, well, a texter is on the bandwagon with Chris Fleming saying, it is very demeaning to your guests to have them so far below the two of you.
It is.
Is this a power thing?
Yes, it is.
Either raise the guest seats or lower your seats.
Well, it's a power thing. We answered the question. It's a power thing. It's not changing. Okay. Now, we know we have the worst set in America, and it is actually in the process of changing.
Okay.
Whatever. So, when I was a lawyer, yep. Marjorie, yep. When the other side is going to bring out something horrible about you or your client, you bring it out yourself. Marjorie is going to ridicule me for my hypocrisy for criticizing Elon Musk, and it is true. I took possession in early December of a Model 3 Tesla. That is true. However, what she will probably not say, I was as gracious enough yesterday to let Marjorie actually ride it.
Yeah.
It is true. She had to wear gloves.
3 minutes.
Maybe three. It was 3 minutes more than I expected. She had to wrap herself in cellophane, wear gloves. Yep. She did get to ride. She was not allowed to touch anything,
including
the massive touchscreen in the center console. But she was well.
Yep.
So we saw the news this morning that Massachusetts, I didn't even know about this, is planning to install tens of thousands of EV electric vehicle chargers across the state in this multi-million dollar effort to encourage a switch of fossil fuel powered cars to EVs. And we're going to open this up to you at 877-301-8970. Would having better access to chargers, because it isn't so great right now, be enough for you to make the conversion to EV? And what are the other roadblocks for you? Is it affordability? The prices, actually, there are a lot of, I would argue, comparably affordable ones. Is it the fear that your Tesla is more or less a MAGA hat on wheels? That is my concern. Maybe you just really love the car you drive. It's already okay on gas. Or should we be skipping cars entirely and just swim to work or whatever it is that some people would like us to do? 877-301-8970. Marjorie, I know you're going to mock me. Before you mock me,
I am going to mock you.
What did you think of the car?
Well, I must say I thought the car was quite impressive.
How much gas did I use driving to Braintree and
zero,
back?
Zero.
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 Zero, yep. Zero gas I used driving to Braintree.
It's great. But, you know, Jim was like kind of a four-year-old in the car. Okay. Mr. Tesla, can you open the glove compartment, please?
I didn't say Mr. Tesla. I didn't say Mr. Tesla.
Can you play Joni Mitchell, please?
I did do that. I did do that. And what did they do? Did it play Joni Mitchell?
It did. And Mr. Tesla, can you move the mirrors on either side of the car?
And it did that,
too. And then you're driving this thing with the front, which I couldn't touch, the front, whatever you call it.
The front.
Big screen.
Oh, the screen.
The big screen.
Yeah.
And on the left-hand side of the screen, you see all the cars all around you on the road.
Okay, fine.
It is unbelievable.
But you know who? Excuse me.
Walking on the side of the road, so you don't run them over.
We want to know what's standing between you and owning an EV, and if you bought one already or rent one already or lease one, why? Mm-hmm. But I should say, Marjorie should ridicule me. Again, I'm a hypocrite vis-a-vis Musk. But having said that, one of us drives an electric vehicle and one does not. I would say that is the bottom line, Marjorie Egan.
I'm waiting for the Toyotas. I have had Toyotas forever. Mm-hmm. And I'm waiting for the Toyotas to make a cheap enough one. They're not doing it yet. They're supposed to have one that's $43,000 next year, but that's still pretty expensive. But I do have a hybrid, Jim.
You do? That's true. You have
I do have a hybrid.
In any case, the number is 877-301.
Had one for almost 20 years.
8970. By the way, 14, not, I don't think that's right. It says, CNN says 14. 13 people appear to have switched their votes. There are only seven Republicans who voted against Kevin McCarthy. He's got to get that down to four, and if he can swing three more, he is the next Speaker of the House. But we're talking about EVs for the rest of the show. By the way, to preempt questions about this, the new rules about rebates from the feds are still unclear. What we do know is you're not even eligible unless you make more than $150,000 as an individual, $225,000 as a head of household, $300,000 as a family of filer. You could get as much as $7,500 back, but don't ask us questions about it unless you know a lot, because the rules are still in a state of flux, I think, with the Internal Revenue Service, whoever it is. But we want to know what stands between you and an EV, assuming there is something that stands there, at 877-301-8970.
Well, you know, there are some cheap ones. There's going to be a lot of cheap ones coming out this year. GM has got the Equinox EV
Oh, that's Chevrolet's. Yeah, that's a GM. Chevrolet's Equinox BEV starts around $30,000.
Yeah, that's not horrible.
Bolt will be for around $30,000 as well. Chevrolet Blazer. I mean, GM's going to have the Silverado EV pickup in production. So there's
If they qualify for the rebate, that's $7,500. That's a quarter of the cost of the car. Mm-hmm. That's pretty huge, by the way.
Yeah, it is pretty huge. And Volkswagen and Toyota are a little bit behind, but they're supposedly going to catch up.
In any case, and also Musk is saying, I can't believe I'm quoting him, that there's going to be a much cheaper, I have the low-end model. By the way, it's a compact car in which I fit all 6 feet, 5 inches of me. He's talking about a much cheaper one in the 30s come next year. I don't know if that's true. Nick and Bourne, you're first on the EV Hour here on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Hey, Jim.
Hey.
Maybe I won't get interrupted by President Biden today.
Oh, was it you yesterday? So sorry, but I think he had something fairly important to say. What's up, Nick?
I did, but it was not about this. But I do have an opinion on this.
Sure.
I think it's more than just the charging stations for most people. But most people are having trouble getting into a 10-year-old gasoline-powered vehicle. You know, the price of vehicles now is so inflated. New and used.
Well, but Nick, I agree with that. Having said that, and I'm not, I know that at this time, there are a lot of people still that can't afford anything other than what they currently have if they're lucky enough to have something. But if you look at the numbers that Marjorie mentioned, a couple of fairly credible makers putting out a car for $30,000 on which a lot of people of moderate income can get a $7,500 rebate, a $22,000 price tag for a decent quality new EV is pretty reasonable in the grand scheme of things, would you not say?
I think it could be reasonable, but who are these automakers that we're speaking of?
What do you mean?
Well, there's Hyundai. They got a Kona Electric. That starts around $30,000. I mentioned the Bolt that's around $30,000. The Chevrolet Equinox, the EV... I mean, there's quite a few.
But what's your point about who are these makers? Okay. I understand avoiding Musk, which I did not. But what's your concern, I mean, about a maker?
I'd love to get into a Tesla, but that's besides the point. No, because the legacy automakers, you know, they have a bit of a reputation.
Well, I think Toyota's got a great reputation. I
mean, in terms of safety and things.
Yeah, in terms of cars you're spending any money on. But it's going to be, they're a little bit behind, but they're going to have a car that's $43,000, which is a good $13,000 more than these other ones. On the other hand, I have a lot of good experience with Toyota, so I'm hoping they're going to have a really good car. And I think when you talk about Nick is right about the price of used cars. They're through the roof, and the price of new, particularly because people haven't been getting rid of them or whatever. But, you know, this is around, when you're talking about $30,000 plus the discount, it's around what you're going to pay for most used cars.
I think that's
true.
That's true. By the way, someone texted and said, is your Tesla self-driven itself into any pedestrians yet? No, it is not. It's $5,000 extra for that software, which I'm not buying, in part because of the $5,000, but also because it scares me. I mean, it really does, the self-driving. The self-driving thing does scare me.
Yeah,
so
I don't want to do any
I'm not
self-driving.
Doing that. Let's go to Emily in Rossendale. Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
So I am the owner of a 2013 used Chevrolet Volt.
Oh.
It can charge up to 30 miles on a charge, so like nothing.
That's
and,
not very much.
My husband and I live in the city, so we don't have a charging station in a driveway or anything like that. So we've honestly kind of given up on using it.
Oh, that's terrible. Well, I mean, it's going to take a while, but they are going to have this $400 million for Massachusetts, which is a pretty big, hefty price. It's going to do homes, apartment buildings, workplaces, public locations like retail parking lots. They're supposedly saving money for charging hubs in neighborhoods where people don't make a whole lot of money. It's going to take them a while to get it out there, and they're going to do this, if you didn't already say this, by putting a surcharge on EverSource National Grid and Unitel.
$4 a month, I think. You know, Emily, the other thing I have to say, this is, in my own defense here, part of the problem is not just the accessibility to chargers, if you can't afford to install one at home, but it's also the time. You often have to leave your car overnight to get fully charged. Tesla sorry.
There you go, Jim.
Has superchargers that can charge your whole tank or whatever they call it. It's not a tank.
Even as we speak.
And I know, in 25 minutes. It's a big deal. But, Emily, that is a serious issue. And you know what I don't understand? For a mayor, we haven't talked to Mayor Wu about this, but we will next time. I think she's here with the 31st. Is that when she's here? 31st of January, Mayor Wu will join us at the library. She's obviously a big EV advocate kind of thing. When I was in Truro during the summer, you drove to the DPW in Truro. You know how much it cost you to charge your car?
I do not know.
Zero.
Zero.
Free on the town. My daughter has a plug-in, and she charged her car. My younger daughter has a plug-in. There are places, for example, in Cambridge near me, the DPW, three blocks from my house. It's still much cheaper than gas. Why to encourage this? Are communities not subsidizing and maybe even making for a year or two the charge free?
I think it'd be a great idea.
I think it'd be a great idea.
I think it would be a great idea. Let's go to. And by the way, she's gone now. But didn't the last caller say was it what was her name?
Emily, I think.
Emily. Did she only get 30 miles? Is that what she said?
Well, it depends what kind of thing you have. I mean, my kid's got a plug-in, and the plug-in only gets, you know, only can do like 40 or 50 miles of electric battery
drive.
You've
got one with
350.
Yes, but a lot of these newer ones, like this Nissan Leaf or the Bolt, they're less than 30 grand, and they have a 250-mile range.
Yeah, and while people
so
say that's
not improved.
Well, not only, I mean, how many people, you know, people say, oh my God, it's not enough when I drive to Colorado. Well, when you drive to Colorado, you find stations along the way. The bottom line is most of us drive locally.
Jim
and don't,
said,
here we
Mr.
go.
Tesla,
don't do this. I
can
can't tell you. By the way, I'm not
station.
Telling you anything. I'm not telling you anything.
You did it in front of me. And the charging stations all came up. And Jim said, thank you, Mr. Tesla.
You know why I did that, by the way? You know why I did that?
Why did you do that?
Because you were touching the glove compartment. We had a deal you wouldn't touch anything in the car. And you kept touching and put your fingerprints
so
all over
the
glove compartment.
So I get out of the car. He said, don't slam the door.
I did say don't slam the door.
And so I was so careful that, of course, it didn't close. The door didn't close because Jim was so paranoid that I was
okay, fine.
The
By the way, someone, are you the one that tells us about Michelle Wu? Mayor Wu is driven in a Ford Mustang. Do you pronounce it Mach-E around the city? I assume that's an electric vehicle. Thank you, Jamie. Let's go to
Ford Mustang. That is a nice car.
Is it Jean-Marie in Hull? Am I pronouncing it right or no?
Yeah, Jean-Marie.
Jean-Marie, I'm sorry. Hi, Jean-Marie.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, I am not French, but I appreciate.
Well, then I'll call you Jean-Marie. Hey, Jean-Marie, how are you?
Yes. I'm fabulous. How
Good.
Are you?
Excellent.
Okay. If I have been through the whole ringer with the electric
cars,
vehicle, charging, distance, planning your trip, ask me. I know it because I've lived it.
Well,
and
it sounds like you've had bad experiences.
Now.
Yes?
Well, it's a learning curve.
It
like
is.
Anything. You know, like it's almost like learning a language. It takes time to get fluent. And so anyway, 2 years ago, I had a regular gas machine. It was a German car at 100,000 miles. It started costing me a lot of money. So I started looking in the electric car market. I found one car that really appealed to me. It happened to be an incentive at that time. It was a 2019 Hyundai Kona.
Yeah.
That particular model also makes a gas version of the same vehicle. The gas version was about $30,000.
Yeah.
The electric version, and this was in 2020, because I bought the car a year old.
You know, with all due respect, Jean Marie, it's going to be 2024 when the story's over. Can you cut to the what's the gist
important.
Of this?
No, okay. It's important.
Sorry.
The gist of this is I bought a 2019 and 2020. And I've had it 2 years, and they gave me $13,000 off the top, which was $42,000
new. Okay, good.
I got an incentive from Hyundai, $12,000 off the top.
I'm going to go get a sandwich.
$29,000
right.
after another thing. So look around for the deal.
Oh, that's it. So what's the bad news? You got a good deal. What are you complaining about?
Okay.
Oh, we're about to hear that.
I'll tell you what the difficulty is trying to find stations. When you're taking a long trip.
Exactly.
That's right.
That
that's
is a
why,
problem. You have to plan. You have to plan. You have to plan. Jean-Marie,
well,
we love you. Thanks for the call.
The Inflation Reduction Act, isn't that putting in a lot of the
charging stations?
Yeah,
I think it's either that or the, I don't know if it's
one
the infrastructure or the one of them.
One of them is.
Yeah.
I mean, and also people are emailing or texting, rather, about living in apartments. that's a problem too, but they're trying to deal that.
You can't charge at home.
Yes, yeah. You cannot charge at home if you don't have a garage. Or if
I can't charge at home. I don't have a driveway, nor do I have a charger.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jim.
That's okay. But can you imagine you trying to find a charger for an electric car? That's Jamie's laugh you hear in the
Mr.
background.
Tesla.
Talk about disrespectful.
I'd be able to say, Mr. Toyota, where's the charging thing? I don't know.
I don't think so, Marjorie.
But they talk to you in this very sexy voice.
Well, they do in the Tesla.
Tesla.
They do. You know what the Tesla said? I pressed the button for Marjorie to press.
Jim,
and it said, Jim, you are looking fine today. I pre-programmed that. And I was looking relatively good yesterday. Marjorie was impressed. Thank God we only have time for one more call
because
we got to get out of here.
Call.
Bob
in
Brighton, you got to make it quick. Welcome. Hi.
Oh, hi. There's two problems with charging stations. Well, I'll make this quick.
Please.
About a third of the charging stations don't work. That's a problem. And the second one is, if the state's going to put in new charging stations, level twos are not practical.
What are
that's
level
the 240.
Twos?
I don't know what that is.
Well, they'll take
that's
about
slow
6 to 7 hours.
Yeah, that's a real problem.
They'll take
You're
six
right.
to 7 hours.
You're totally right.
Whereas a level three will take you about 20 minutes. With level threes, they're very expensive.
They are. And that's what the Tesla supercharger is. Which
How much
is,
are level threes, Jim? Ask Mr. Tesla.
No, I don't have any idea what they are. I plug in. Bob says
they're $90,000 to $100,000
to construct
for two
one.
Ports.
Oh.
For two ports.
Oh, okay.
Bob, thanks.
But I mean, if you go to the charge,
it's a little more expensive than the slower charger.
For the 20-minute charging station, how much does that cost?
I mean, it's about a third to a quarter of what gas would cost for the same amount, and it's a little less if you go to a typical slow. Comparatively slow charge.
Okay, so instead of being like $4 a gallon, it would be $1.
Like a dollar. Well, there's not a gallon because it's a charge
in
your car.
To the gasoline
exactly.
you normally put. So it's, you're paying 75% less is what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, just being clear about that.
Thank God this is over.
Yep, Mr. Tesla, Jim's car is right outside.
You're never driving my car again, by the way. Let me just say right now. You're never touching it. You're never driving in it.
A little spaceship. Yeah. My car's out there too. It's a little Toyota.
Four.
It's a little ridiculous.
No bumper on the back.
I have a bumper in the back.
Okay, you want to say goodbye? We have a minute. Thank you all for coming, by the way, because Marjorie's never going to remember that.
Okay. Keep up with this 24/7 the way of our podcast. I cannot see the clock. You're going to have to.
You have 50 seconds.
50 seconds.
Thank everybody.
On Monday, we're going to have two local doctors with us for a program about pairing doulas with expectant mothers.
That's great.
In an effort to combat high maternal mortality rates and racial inequities in healthcare. We'll also hear from Washington Post EJD on our transit panel with Jim Aloisi and Stacey Thompson, the Revs Irene Monroe and Emmett Price, and presidential inaugural poet Richard Blanco for the first Village Voice segment of the year. I want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Ed and Colin, Mackenzie Farkas. Additional support provided by Brendan Deedy. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker with Bill Piacitelli and Brian Bell on the board for us today. Our executive producer is Jenny Bologna. And with the BPL team, Colin Cockrell, Evelyn Brito, and Sai Patel, I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browning.
Thank you so much for tuning
Thanks
in.
Thanks for being here.
Have a nice weekend. Hope you can tune in on Monday.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For listening.